Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Newbury Court, a full-service retirement community in Concord, Massachusetts. Newbury Court is committed to creating active, independent lifestyles for persons 62 and over. More at newburycourt.org.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, we're starting off the week by opening the lines. Good news for the first time in a long time when it comes to Russia's war against Ukraine. But after nearly 8 months, it's the first time many of us have paid any attention to this atrocity. At the same time, we're all in 24/7 on the death of Queen Elizabeth. What does that say about us?
Then Ken Burns on his latest documentary detailing how American anti-Semitism and anti-immigrant prejudice directly led to the genocide of Jews in World War II. Then across the country and here in the Commonwealth, workers at Starbucks are making history in their push for labor unions and workers' rights. By BU, they're leading the longest strike in the country's history. We'll get the latest, all that ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GB. Mr. Brody, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Happy Monday, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
And are you now going to say we'll be at the Boston Public Library tomorrow?
Oh, we are going to be at the Boston Public Library tomorrow. We're going to have an hour for Ask the Mayor with Mayor Michelle Wu. She'll be with us at the library tomorrow. That starts at 11 o'clock.
And at noon today, we'll be joined, as Marjorie just said, by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. Marjorie and I both watched their new six-hour documentary on the Holocaust that is just otherworldly. In any case, today, after what seemed like nonstop coverage of the Queen of England's death for much of the weekend, with many more days to come, Ukraine is back in the news after a string of military victories against Russia, pushing back Russia's forces in the northeast. CNN Business is even reporting the developments are, quote, exciting the stock market domestically. But let's face it, we have lost interest in the slaughter of Ukrainians, but are all in 24/7 on the death of a monarch. So our question at 877-301-8970, either text or call, is what does this say, this juxtaposition of nonstop coverage of the death of Queen Elizabeth and virtually no coverage of what's happening in Ukraine, what does it say about us? 877-301-8970. I'm assuming, were it not for this incredible turn of events, I don't know if it's going to be temporary or long-term, we're going to talk about it with some experts on Greater Boston tonight, there wouldn't be any coverage of Ukraine. I don't know if I told you, the day after Queen Elizabeth died, on my phone, and that's sometimes different from what's on your computer, but on my phone, online, the top 14 out of 14 stories were about Queen Elizabeth. By the way, another day we can talk about the fact not one of them had a critical comment about her reign. That's, again, a topic for another day. But it's all Queen Elizabeth, virtually nothing about a war that is killing thousands and thousands and thousands of innocent people. And you know why? That's what we see on our TV screens and our newspapers, because they know what we want, which is we want a monarch's death. We have no interest in this war.
Well, I think in general, we in the media can be found guilty of caring an awful lot about deaths and an awful lot about weddings. We are really into, remember, people were getting up in the wee hours of the morning to watch Diana wed Charles years ago. You and I were watching Kate Middleton wed William. It was rather breathless, as I recall.
I wasn't enjoying it, though. I want to be clear. Okay. One of us was breathless.
We love to record the people being waked in state in Congress.
You mean celebrity deaths? You don't mean the average
politician's
death? Well, not like a Ukrainian in eastern Ukraine.
No, okay. I mean people lying in state in the rotunda of Congress.
Of course, we
cover those kinds of things. I mean, there's a thing. I don't know if we're attracted to ceremonies. I mean, we have seen nonstop pictures. Now we've got up. What do we got there? They're in Westminster Abbey, I believe. Are they not? Or they're in some church somewhere. Oh, no. They're in a cathedral in Edinburgh, Scotland. I stand corrected. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. With the Queen there. So we're going to be seeing this nonstop. And then we have the funerals not till several days from now. And then we'll see all that. And we'll see Biden going over there to the funeral. Apparently, they only invited Biden and the First Lady, avoiding the controversy over whether or not Biden would be inviting Trump as part of the American delegation to the funeral. That's not going to happen, I guess.
Oh, I didn't know that. In any case, 877-301-8970. 1989-70. And again...
Jim, don't forget. You know what people really want to know?
Okay.
What was going to happen to the corgis? We now know that.
You know, you're making light of this. It really is people want to blame... Well, if they want to blame anybody, they want to blame the media. Media doesn't, for the most part, with some exceptions, doesn't just decide what... It's particularly television. It doesn't decide sort of in an abstract way. They do... surveying. They know what the public wants. The public wants Queen Elizabeth 24/7 and apparently has no interest in the messy, much messier situation. Well, actually, that's pretty messy too, but the much messier situation in Ukraine. And it's really troubling.
We are also pointing out, better late than never, the brutality of the empire in which the sun never set, which is the line you always heard about the British Empire. You know, with people writing stories, Nigerians are writing about how their family was brutalized in massacres. I said before that I was getting some tweets and email from people, or texting, I should say, from here, saying, how can I be celebrating this queen being an Irish American, which I am, and they were brutal, absolutely brutal to the Irish in a really almost sadistic kind of way in India and in Ireland and Ghana and all these other countries that the British were particularly heinous towards. So it's a record of brutality, and as people complain, the Queen was not exactly speaking out against this.
Right, and it also took 3 days to get there. But that, again, and I think most of the media, not all of it, was dragged kicking and screaming there because they were sort of embarrassed by the gloss they're putting on this. But regardless of what you're covering, even if you covered it more responsibly, as you're just describing, there's no interest in something where the impact, or at least the impact that should be on us, is namely this war. It gets nearly the same attention, and it should trouble us all, I think. Let's go to Sarah in Billingham. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me. So
sure.
I wanted to ask you guys' opinion. When you asked that question just a little while ago about why, you know, they're covering the Queen so much more than Ukraine, you know what I thought of? I thought of Eliza Fletcher, and it's heartbreaking what happened to Eliza Fletcher, and then I thought about Hugh Rodney.
Tell us, Sarah, about Eliza Fletcher.
She was kidnapped and murdered. Very affluential, rich, a kindergarten teacher. And it's very
in Tennessee.
Oh, this is the
in
woman
Tennessee.
Right with the video.
Oh, okay.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
But Keeley Rodney, the drunk teenager that, I guess, disappeared and was found in a lake, there was much less, you know, reporting on that, and that's what my mind went to. It's like, why do they choose the Queen and Eliza Fletcher over Ukraine and a poor missing teenager?
What do you think the answer is, Sarah? What do you think the answer is?
The audience that maybe they're trying to capture? I don't know. I can't really.
I think it's...
Well,
unqualifiedly, that actually.
There's been a lot of reporting, Sarah, on on the media's ignoring the deaths of African American women and reporting on the deaths of white women, particularly
blonde white
women. And the teacher in Tennessee was a blonde woman, and the alleged killer was a black guy. So it may be back to that old sad state of affairs. But I certainly think that young, good-looking white blonde women seem to get unfair coverage in the media, and you know, that's pretty disgraceful, I guess.
Sarah, thank you for the call. 877-301-8970 is the number. I have to say, you know, there's no bigger fan of Anderson Cooper than I. And when you watch 2 hours of Anderson Cooper and he practically is in tears about the royal family and the suffering they're doing, and I'm sure they're all missing their mother, their sister, their whatever. Don't you think this is the new CNN, what we've heard? This is essentially more of what the public wants as opposed to what the news really is. 877-301-8970 is our phone number.
Alyssa in New York, thank you for calling.
Hey.
Hi.
Hi.
Oh, I'm so glad this is a topic today, because I was shocked at how much coverage the Queen is getting, and I really do like it's being forced on me by the media over not just what's happening in the Ukraine, but on the anniversary of 9/11. I was just shocked that I just felt like the top of every news show I watched was the Queen, and then the relationship of the brothers, and then, you know, how the monarchy is going to change. And I kept saying to my mom, like, we're not a colony anymore, right? Like, anyway.
Well, listen, really the one I wish I had thought of what you said a second ago. If I hear one more story about whether or not this is going to be lead to a rapprochement between the two brothers, who gives a damn? I mean, who cares whether William and
Harry?
Well,
the family has become a soap opera, an endless
like
source of.
Yeah.
I mean, you got one brother that's involved with allegedly having sex with 17-year-old girls, a Jeffrey Epstein thing. Before that, he was married to a woman who later had an affair, and we all saw pictures of the boyfriend sucking on her toes. But then we discovered that the queen, the late queen,
yeah, liked her,
and they were quite friendly, even though Andrew and she were divorced. Then, of course, you had all the speculation of what's going on with Harry and Meghan. Did Harry make a mistake by leaving the United Kingdom? Is Meghan leading him around by the nose? Is Meghan really being treated horribly because of racism? I mean, it's an endless soap opera. And that's one of the contrasts of the Queen. The Queen has been rather sparse in her public remarks, and supposedly that was keeping people united. But as many people have complained about, you know, all the atrocities that went on in other countries. And we did, there was quite a bit about 9/11, I thought, yesterday. It's not the 20, it's not, it's the, what is it, the 20... 21st anniversary of 9/11. It's not
21st, correct?
Because the media also loves anniversaries of things. Mm-hmm. Usually, we when it's something as far away, we decide the 5th anniversary or the 10th anniversary. We don't usually do the odd years. Yesterday, I thought we did quite a bit. President Biden gave quite a lengthy speech about 9/11. I thought he could have made a much less lengthy speech. Actually, it kind of did go on and on and on. But in any case, 877-301-8970.
Listen to this. I didn't see this myself, but Paula sends us a text. Breaking news banner on Washington Post right now. Above the article on Ukraine, this can't be true. It says Queen's corgis will be taken care of by Prince Andrew and Fergie.
That's right. That's right.
That's true.
That's right. Yes, that's what I was telling you. Everybody
the Ukraine story?
Well, I wasn't going to say it was above the Ukraine story, but there was a big story about what was going to happen to the corgis. Apparently, there's some other dogs that are going to go to other people, but the corgis are going to go to Prince Andrew. What's her name?
Fergie. She's the Weight Watchers spokesperson.
She was the Weight Watchers spokesperson for quite a while. She's the one who had her toes sucked by the boyfriend and get on all the tabloids. Jim from Sharon. Hi, Jim.
Hello, Jim.
Apparently, there's some other dogs that are going to go to other people.
Oops. That's me still talking.
Oh. Hi, Jim. How are you?
I think Jim forgot to turn off his radio.
Hi, Jim. We're going to put you on hold. You got to turn off the radio deal. We'll get back to you after we talk to another one of your fellow callers in a second.
Peg from Needham is upset. She says, talk with the networks and their management. You all drive the news. I'm disgusted by the poor quality of both local news and national news. How can we as consumers affect real change? You know, I get really annoyed when I get these messages, because if you have a problem with the local news, Needham, Reg from Needham, you got to support the local papers. People don't want to pay for news. They want to get it for free now, and that's why we don't have any more local papers reporting these terrible problems in local jurisdictions, and why the Boston Globe is shrinking every day, because people do not want to pay for
Boston Globe is doing remarkably well, by the way.
The Boston Globe is doing remarkably well.
I have the managing editor with me tonight. It's turned a profit.
But the Boston Globe is shrinking in size. You've all noticed
that. That's because display ads also are gone. I mean, that's another piece of the reason.
Right. Everybody wants to get their news for cheap online, or they don't even want to pay for it online. And so I feel very strongly about we screw the newspapers by not supporting the newspapers in our local towns. Jim from Sharon, thank you for calling.
Hey, this is Tim in Sharon. Thank you.
Tim, hi.
Hey there.
Hi.
So I've been raising funds for canine dogs, the search and rescue dogs in Ukraine. And I did a great job. I raised like $12,000 in the beginning and was able to send over a bunch of vests. But it's been very difficult to find people to contribute lately. So
why do you think that is?
I'm quite disappointed.
Why do you think that is?
Oh, it's not because of the queen. I think it's just what I've been hearing on the news, that people get burnt out and tired and they move on to the next exciting thing. But there's so much suffering all the time over there every day.
Jim, it's great what you did and are doing, and thank you for your call. We really appreciate it. By the way, the pets whole situation, you know, a lot of the people who are crossing the borders, we talked about this at the time, weren't allowed to bring their pets with them. Can you imagine that?
No.
I mean, I understand, I guess, why they do it. Couldn't bring them on trains because the trains were packed already. I guess it makes sense, but it's really painful, needless to say. 877-301-8970 is our number.
Here's another text. When I was younger, I remember listening to morning shows like the Today Show or Good Morning America. They covered actual news, events of the day, analysis and interviews with heads of state. Today, it's all day drinking and fashion advice. I didn't know that. The show that used to have 50 to 60% solid news is now to maybe 10 minutes at the beginning of the hour. And I think people complain about the nighttime shows. It's too much punditry, too much talking heads than actually going out and covering the news. But I got to say,
that's what the new head of CNN says.
Yeah, but the new head of CNN, I mean, who was over there with incredible coverage of the war in Ukraine?
Yeah.
It was CNN.
Yeah,
I mean, I would say they did without doubt the best coverage.
By the way, if you want a morning show, I mean, I understand what they say, but I listened to our morning show this morning, Paris and Jeremy.
Yeah,
it was
all
news driven, ton of local news, fact based stuff.
That's right. Without question, Jim. We're doing it right here at GBH.
Well, it doesn't go without. Nothing goes without question. But the reality is, I listen and they're doing it. They're doing what they should be doing.
We're talking about an overload on the Queen. What do you make of it? You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie and live at the Boston Public Library, joined by Mayor Wu for an hour for Ask the Mayor. Did you hear what the promo on for National Public Radio was? We went to the break talking about how the news is too focused on the Queen,
Ukraine.
No, all about Ukraine.
Oh, all about Ukraine.
And what's going on there, going into
very
the neighborhoods.
Good.
So if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the war in Ukraine and our sadly short American attention spans. We'd rather focus on the death of a foreign monarch than a fight for the future survival of democracy.
Yeah.
What does that say about us? Our number for texting and calling is 877-301-8970.
One of my favorite stories of the day, our producer Jamie Bologna pointed this out to me, that American capitalists, any opportunity to get more publicity for their brands, all these big companies are tweeting their sorrow and mourning the death of Queen. Everybody at Domino's is mourning the death of the Queen, apparently. The people at Shrek's Adventure, a family-friendly attraction in London, they are mourning the death of the Queen. The lingerie brand and sex toy provider Anne Summers shared a photo of a young queen with "Thank You, Your Majesty" written underneath it. Hamilton, the musical, they are mourning the death of the queen. McDonald's is mourning the death of the queen. You may ask yourself, what does the death of the queen have to do with the fries and double cheeseburgers at McDonald's? But I guess
I'll tell you what else to do with it. They'll sell more fries and burgers if it turns out they show interest in the death of the queen. 877-301-8970 is our phone number.
Roy in Boston, thank you for calling.
Hello there, Roy.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good.
I was just listening to your show, and I'm thinking, I kind of agree with your sentiment where, you know, why should I care about the death of this monarch? There's all these other things going on. And I wanted to share something I saw on the internet the other day. It was, you know, a picture of one of those double-decker buses in London.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a wrap on it, kind of some sort of political propaganda supporting Brexit. And it said, we send, you know, £300 million over to the EU every year for this. But the NHS, the National Health Service in the UK, is not funded. And I'm sitting here wondering, what about this random family that you've been propping up for 500 years, 600 years? How much money do you spend on that? Divert that to the NHS. I think... I mean, you know, it's sad that someone died, of course, but I don't think I should be any more or less sad about the Queen dying than somebody's grandmother or another old.
Well, exactly. Roy, I'm mostly with you. The reality is she does have influence in certain parts of the world, some good, some bad. Neither Marjorie nor I are saying it's not newsworthy. It's absolutely newsworthy. The Queen's 70 years longest serving monarch there, or second or something, is dead. But the question is balance and focus. And I think they've gone overboard. Roy, but thanks for the call.
I just thought of this, and I've forgotten about it, but Roy reminded me. You know Mary Pfeiffer? She wrote Reviving a Few years ago. She writes a lot of stuff about families and women. She wrote something about women growing north, about the second half of life and stuff. She had a great theory that we don't know our neighbors very well, but we love to kind of join in this collective grief about things. You know, we love to sit in front of the TV set and kind of get weepy about the Queen, or when Princess Diana died, people were beside themselves. They never met this woman. She's had no role in their life except that they read about her. And there's something about that that people seem to enjoy. You know what I mean?
Well, it's not just that, by the way. A variation of what you're talking about is there are a lot of organizations that are political that are far more invested in things that they can have no influence on than things they can. And you know why? Because the things you can have influence on, you have to do something. And the thing that are further away, you have the ability to just tweet or nod your head in sadness and that sort of thing.
And how many people have died now from COVID? Over a million,
Over
right?
a million, yeah.
Over a million. That's more than in all the wars.
In the United States, over a million,
Over a million people in all the wars. It's certainly more than the tragedy of 9/11. It's more than any other tragedy, you know, we've had in this country.
Well, it's not just a tragedy. It goes beyond that, because I think fair-minded people would say many of those million-plus deaths didn't have to happen were it not for the fact that we had a homicidal president in the United States.
But I'm wondering when we're going to have the kind of national day of mourning for COVID-19.
Yeah,
because when you talk about what has affected people's lives, I would certainly think that COVID-19 did really a number on lots of people's lives. Charlotte in Mansfield. Hi, Charlotte.
Hello, Charlotte.
Hi.
Hi.
Sorry, my car is beeping. I'm actually a dual citizen from the UK. I've been in the US for sort of 16, 17 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to kind of get an expat perspective on the balance of the coverage for the Queen and with obviously Ukraine and other things, in that people have been asking me why are people so upset about the passing of the Queen? And it's very difficult to explain when in the US you have no real equivalent of someone of this sort of magnitude who's been in your life, your entire life. And my mother actually suggested it was like when JFK died. Imagine, sort of remember all of the coverage that happened then, the fascination with Jackie Kennedy and the children afterwards. And I think people just forget that she's been the main sort of mainstay. She's been there pretty much our entire lives. And so it's sort of, and this is a once in a lifetime.
Yeah, but Charlotte, the one difference in where I take issue with your, even though you have the experience and I don't, she's the queen for the UK. She's not the queen for the United States. JFK was the president of the United States.
And but you also have to appreciate how many expats we have, especially in places like New England. A lot of people have recent ancestry there, but she was a global figure, a Commonwealth sort of. She sort of, we have the neighbor in Canada, you have Australia, and yes, there is sort of obviously colonial history and those aspects to it, but even though you have the president of the United States, that's the thing. The president of the United States is only there for 8 years.
Yeah, Charlotte, I hear you.
The length of time that she came into power back, well, power such as it is when you're the queen, in with Winston Churchill.
Yeah. Well, Charlotte, you make a lot of good points. I guess all we're arguing, not that there should be no coverage and not that we don't understand the interest in some parts of the world, but I guess we're talking about relativity here, and that things that also matter, like, as I said, the survival of a democracy that we support, probably deserves at least equal time. Charlotte, thanks for your thoughts. We really appreciate it.
Here's a good one from Bob in Boston.
What's that?
Overload on the Queen? I have an idea. Why don't you talk about the overload on the Queen? Touché, Bob.
Good point. Thank you. 877-301 89-70 is our phone number. By the way, credit since we've been trashing you, CNN, the last few minutes with Kate Baldwin has been about Ukraine recapturing large parts in the north and the east of Ukraine from the Russians.
Which, you
and
know, by the is way, pretty amazing, is
not
it
only
not?
Is it amazing, it is apparently, I don't know if it's a short-lived thing. I'm going to talk to my two experts tonight, Carol Savitz and Tom Nichols. I know you see Tom Nichols not as a military expert, but rather as a five-time Jeopardy champion, which he was, about whether or not this long-term weakens the hand of Putin. This is an embarrassment for Putin and his troops. So hopefully it does some of the weakening that they believe is necessary to cause this thing to end.
Now, here is a theory from Heather in Medford. She thinks CNN is tailoring their content to the shrinking cable TV audience because young people don't have cable. So maybe it's more older people
that are
interested.
I think that's a wonderful point, actually.
Yeah, interested, especially during the daytime when most people are working, they're not at home watching television.
Young people read the New York Times online, though. 14 out of 14 stories the other day at the top.
That's true.
And so I agree with the cable part of it. That's a good point. Elizabeth and Franklin, you're on Boston Public Radio. We really appreciate your call. Hi.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie.
Hey.
So I just had to, how are you?
Good. We're good.
So my daughter is in seventh grade and she's 12 and came home the other day broken. She was like, Mom, Dad, did you hear the Queen died? And apparently, like, all of her little friends went home and were like broken apart. They're like, we want to wear black for the Queen tomorrow.
Oh,
like,
my gosh.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, furthermore, her great grandmother died 3 weeks ago, and she wasn't wearing black for her. So,
that's a good one.
Oh my God! I thought it was her being dramatic, but apparently, like the entire seventh grade was going to wear black for the Queen that day.
So, So what's your analysis, Elizabeth? Why?
So I think, well, number one, I think 12 years old and hormones and everyone's freaking out over the Queen. But I think that there is something really to be said about collective grief, you know, and I think that's why people do get so wrapped up in, you know, Meghan and Harry and the wedding. And, you know, I think that maybe with everything that's going on in the world, people need something to unite them. I mean, I don't know. That's my two thoughts.
Yeah,
she did not wear black the next day, though.
That's a great one.
Collective grief, the collective mourning thing, that we like to be involved in kind of collective grief toward people we have no relationship with in real life. Why did half of America get up at, what did they get up at, 3 o'clock in the morning to watch Diana wed Charles all those years ago? And Kimberly Storrs.
By the way, you're part of the problem. You were all in, to say the least. All in.
Excuse me.
Why?
Excuse me. As I recall, you had a recurring theme all during the wedding of Kate and William.
Which was it? Oh, don't say that on it. Really, don't.
Yeah.
Say
well,
that on
okay.
air.
Well, it was kind of
that was
a low,
off the air.
It was a
theme.
Lowbrow obsession, which we will not go into.
Really?
I was looking at the wedding, and you were looking at other things. Which
I was.
Is too embarrassed.
I don't remember that far back. Thank you.
I do.
Elizabeth, thanks for your call. I forgot about that.
Okay.
That
that was pretty.
But by
bad
the way,
too.
The only reason I had that position is because you were talking about it nonstop. By the way, on a serious note, to move away from Marjorie embarrassing me, which is what she's created a cottage industry of doing. If collective grief is the issue, is Elizabeth talked about, where her kids were in black for the Queen to school, but not for her great-grandmother who died a few weeks ago. I think we can have collective grief for the tens of thousands of people in Ukraine who've been slaughtered by the Russians, too. And I know they're not identifiable individually like the Queen is, but in the grand scheme of things, I would argue that their fight for democracy may be a tad more important than the death of a monarch.
But that's one of your great themes that we're going to talk about in a few minutes with Ken Burns about the Holocaust thing. That 6 million Jews is a horrible, horrible number, but the story of one individual family.
That was one of the best parts of the documentary. How brilliantly
is what
they did that.
Really gets you going. And I think that sadly is. Or maybe not sadly, but that's kind of a human nature sort of thing.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, I have been,
right.
Speaking of CNN, following the plight of that one woman that's been in the basement with her three kids for days.
That Anderson
really
Cooper
short
has
hair.
All the time, yeah.
Yeah. You,
husband's a journalist, by the way, even though he's now out there with a weapon. By the way, speaking of that, Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, whose new documentary on the Holocaust airs on September 8th. They will join us in studio at 12 o'clock.
Anyway, coming up, coffee shop workers have become the face of the modern labor movement. We'll be joined by one of the local organizers and our Cornell researcher. I thought we had this backwards here.
No, we're going to talk to Rafi, the worker, and then we're going to talk to Kate Bronfenbrenner.
I wanted to make sure I didn't goof this up. Jim has it correct, as always. That's up next. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie, and we're live at the Boston Public Library tomorrow. Michelle Wu will join us for an hour of Ask the Mayor. So more than 200 Starbucks locations around the country have voted to unionize in recent months. Much has been said of the growing labor movement in the wake of the pandemic, at least support for the labor movement, with workers feeling empowered to unionize in non-traditional locations like coffee shops. But just a handful of those Starbucks locations have actually made it to the bargaining table. None, I believe, have inked a contract yet. At a Starbucks near Boston University, workers are engaged in the longest strike in company history, which has been ongoing for the past month. In a couple of minutes, we're going to take a step back from Starbucks and look at the state of labor movement in general with Kate Bronfenbrenner, who is the Director of Labor Education Research at Cornell University. But first, we're joined by Rafi in studio. He's a Starbucks worker involved in unionization efforts. Rafi, thanks so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure.
So, Rafi, how long have you been there?
I've been with the company for 3.5 years. I got hired in January of 2019.
And in 2019, I might have been just ignorant about the situation at Starbucks, but in 2019, I kind of thought of Starbucks being a pretty good place to work. Is that what you thought when you first started?
When I first started, it was all right. It was better than other jobs that I had had. I was a cook for a few months before I got hired, and it was definitely a more relaxed environment, a more accepting environment, but the company itself has not always been like... It hasn't stayed that way for me in my perspective.
Why, you know, I think a big question for most people is why? Why do you think this has caught on like wildfire? If it was one or two locations, you'd say, well, I understand that, I guess. But it's happening, as I mentioned, all over the country. Is there a common thread, Rafi, do you think, through what's going on with you and your coworkers?
I mean, I think just the visibility of it, like people see that it's happening and they kind of are able to connect, you know, I have these experiences at work, you know, I feel like I don't have control over my work environment. I feel like my boss doesn't listen to me when I make requests. And when you see other workers say, hey, if we work together, we can push and ask for those things, ask for that control and that power in our work environment. When you see that happening outside of just your Starbucks, when you see it happening in Buffalo, when you see it happening in the South, it's something that you want for yourself.
You know, I'm so glad you said that because, you know, I think many people believe, well, this is about wages and benefits only, and wages and benefits, comparatively speaking, are maybe not as horrible as they may be somewhere else. What you're basically saying is you want a voice in decision making about the place you work and your work life, some power, so there's sort of equality in that equation. Is that not where you're going?
That's exactly correct. Something that like really struck me about Starbucks, and this is something that I talk about frequently, is we have all these wonderful benefits. We have, you know, relatively speaking, in fast food, which is what Starbucks is, decent wage. But we don't have control over our hours. Our schedules change every single week, every single day. And it's something that a lot of people want to see a change in. And the other piece of that, too, is that we don't have control over whether or not we get fired tomorrow. If my benefits are excellent, that's great. But if I don't have the power to keep them, if my employer has the power to terminate me without cause tomorrow, then what does it matter if my benefits are good? What does it matter if
And by the way, there are a lot of allegations of Starbucks firing people involved in unionization efforts, even though they deny it. So this is not just a fantasy thing, but a reality.
You know, the whole thing about not being knowing about your hours and not having them set from week to week or day to day is one of the most insane things I've ever heard. There's no sure way to drive workers crazy. You can't make plans to go have dinner with somebody. You can't make childcare plans if you're taking courses. You can't know if you're going to be free to do your courses. So what in the world? And you hear this at a lot of places. What is the thinking that you, the excuse you hear for that?
Turnover. It's just turnover. We don't have the work. We don't have the workforce necessary to cover every single shift. So people need to have the availability to be six different workers in one.
So what does that mean for your life that you can't make those kind of plans? And
Buffy is laughing if you didn't hear that when Marjorie asked the question.
It's a little bit complicated, you know. I work a lot of very varied hours. I'm lucky enough that I work in downtown Boston, so I'm able to go out after work without too much issue. But it does cause, like, sleep. Sleep is the number one. Like, if I go to work at 5:30 one day and I go in at 10 the other, how do I decide when to go to bed? How do I figure out where am I getting my 8 hours in?
That's a great question. So, because if you had to be at work at 5:30, you got to get up pretty damn early in the morning.
Yes, ma'am.
So okay. We're talking to Rafi, who's involved in the unionization efforts at Starbucks. Howard Schultz is the founder of the company. Obviously, he left, ran for president for about a minute and a half, and then decided to come back, essentially to kill the unionization drive. Here he is describing the union efforts, Howard Schultz, as, quote, an outside force during a leaked video in a call with executives back in the spring. Here's Schultz.
The challenges are multiple. The pandemic, a post-pandemic customer, the relationship we have with our customers, competitive threats, and now a new outside force that's trying desperately to disrupt our company.
By the way, for those who are not familiar with organizing drives, whether it's Amazon with Chris Smalls or you and your colleagues, it's always an outside force coming to disrupt the company. Is that true?
Absolutely not. I don't know a single organizer. Like, every worker that I've organized with for Starbucks has been a long-time Starbucks employee. I've met a handful who got very excited when they got hired on, you know, in the last year. They're like, yes, let me help out. But every single worker who has been putting their nose to the grindstone has been 3, 4, 5, up to like 12 years with Starbucks.
And can you describe whether it's at your workplace? And by the way, we should explain it, but you asked us not to mention your specific workplace. Why is that, by the way, Robbie?
My store, unfortunately, lost its election in the spring, specifically due to an issue with benefits where Starbucks was denying those rights, those particular benefits that were being rolled out to unionized workers.
Actually, you do have some experience with it. I was going to say, even if you don't have experience with it, what's the response of the company been like across the country to this effort on the part of their own workers deciding we want a voice in our lives, work lives?
Utterly hostile. Absolutely. Like, no holds barred. Complete, like, unfiltered contempt for what we're doing and a complete unwillingness to cooperate with us and to even come to the table. I know you might have heard about the store on 874 Commonwealth Ave.
Sure.
On strike for over nearly 2 months now. They have not had a single conversation with their district manager about ending the strike, about having their demands met. They won't even make the phone call.
Just to emphasize that point, you said before, Rafi, that there were improvements to benefits, but they were not going to go to places that had unionized. Just elaborate on that. I mean, so what exactly did that mean?
So there was a memo, an internal document that went out to every worker in the country that was saying, okay, on August 1st, a bunch of these benefits are going to get rolled out. That's going to include introducing craft trainings for people who want to improve their coffee knowledge. That includes transportation coverage for gender-affirming and abortion care for workers in places where they are unable to access those things. And another, like, a long list of other, like, pretty big ticket and highly desirable. That was the number one. They picked benefits to roll out that would attract workers, that would people would get excited about, and then just tacked on at the end, oh, if your store is unionized or is in the process of unionizing, these will not be accessible to you.
By the way, my understanding is the National Labor Relations Board has also filed a complaint saying that they what they did was improper and violation of law. Last question for you, Rafi, at least from me. What do you want? I buy Starbucks. What do you want me to do? What do you want Marjorie to do? What do you want listeners to do who are traditionally Starbucks customers? How do we support what you're doing?
Keep going to Starbucks. Go to the works. Go to the stores that are unionized. Find out what locations near you are filing and help them out.
How do we do that?
There should be a I'm actually going to have to look that up, to be honest.
Can you let if you let us know through our producers, we'll
absolutely
let people know.
There's you can take the no contract, no coffee pledge. You can become a community supporter with us and have our organizers reach out to you so you can find out, okay, how do I help the stores that want help filing?
And Rafi, one last thing for me. What has this meant for your own individual situation in terms of your working environment?
It's been scary, to be honest, because I know that there's a high risk to get fired for what I do. This is my only job. I've been with the company, again, almost 4 years, and this is how I pay my bills, right? The reason why I don't share my last name on these publications, the reason why I don't share my workplace, is because if my boss, my district manager, finds out what I do for the labor movement, there is a very high chance that I will get cut loose. And then that's all my rent. That's all my medical bills. Gone.
Well, there's a pretty good chance they're going to find out today. And we hope that those kinds of things don't befall you. Rafi, want to stay in touch with you. Let us know about how to identify unionized locations. Good luck with your work, and thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming in. And I hope this will work out.
Thank you very much.
Starbucks worker Rafi is involved in unionization efforts. We're now joined by Kate Bronfenbrenner. Kate is the Director of Labor Education Research and a Senior Lecturer at Cornell University School of Industrial and Labor Relations and the co-director of the Worker Empowerment Research Project. Kate, good to see you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Hi. So Kate, we've talked a lot about Starbucks. We just talked about it with Rafi. We've talked a lot about efforts at Amazon. Does this mean that there's something really changing in terms of Americans' attitude toward unionization, or are these just outliers?
There absolutely has been a change in the American public's attitude towards unionization. Right now, 71% feel positively and believe that unions are a good thing. This is, this number was down as low as 35%, the last several decades. So this is a big increase. We also know that 52% of workers said that if they could vote for a union, they would, yet only 6.1% of workers in the private sector are organized, and just a little over 10% overall. So we have this big representation gap between, the number of workers who want unions and the number who are in, and the public support for unions compared to where our unionization density is.
Kate, it seems to me to get to that place where anywhere close to 52% of the workers would have an opportunity to vote for a union, we need law changes, not just attitude changes, which obviously are happening as evidenced by the numbers you're talking about. But Marjorie and I were talking off air. We've actually talked on air about it in the past. I used to be a president of a union, and I know in those days and now, employers say to themselves after their lawyer says, well, it's illegal to fire Jane Doe for unionization efforts. And many employers say it may be illegal, but it's going to kill the unionization drive. And by the time the NLRB or some state agency says, I broke the law, we'll rehire Jane Doe, pay her back money, and it's a good cost of doing business. So as long as that weapon exists and the ability to just completely ignore the obligation to collectively bargain, there are going to be real problems, aren't there?
Yes, there's no question. The penalties that exist for employer violations for labor law are less than parking tickets in most cases. They, and when you think of the multi-billion-dollar corporations where workers are organizing, they could afford, even if there were fines, those wouldn't mean nothing to them because, Amazon or Starbucks, $30,000 fine, $100,000 fine, that again would be a small cost to keep a union out. These companies that are refusing unionization and they're refusing to recognize the legitimacy of the National Labor Relations Act, these are companies that could afford to pay whatever the workers are asking and still keep making these profits. But they're objecting unionization because they have this belief that's uniquely American of incorporations, that they have the right to manage free from any interference, right, from government regulation of any kind, from their workers having a voice in the say of the work. And they are willing to stop at nothing to keep unions out.
You know, I was asking Rafi about this because I cannot imagine working any place where I didn't know more or less what my schedule was going to be. There's always going to be emergencies or something where you may have to stay late. But you hear this, you heard this with hotel workers, where the people that were cleaning the rooms couldn't get a schedule, so they couldn't arrange their childcare, they couldn't arrange their rides to work. Rafi was talking about that, not knowing whether the workday was going to start at 5:30 in the morning or 10 o'clock in the morning. It's just, what's going on with this, Kate? I mean, it just, there's no sure way to have a miserable workforce and never to know when you're going to be working.
Right, and it's not just a matter of short staffing. It's the idea that employers want the most flexibility possible, and they'll get that at the expense of workers. Many of these workers are low-wage workers. Transportation costs and childcare costs are a huge part of their budget, and if you change their schedule, they suddenly have to find a new way to work. They have to find an alternate childcare, and that's going to eat away the ability to pay their rent or feed their children. So these are fundamental issues, and these are the reasons that workers organized. They felt that, you know, over the last decade, that employers have stopped to see them as human beings and have ignored their health and safety during COVID, ignored their ability to take care of their families by changing their schedules, and are just not listening to them about their concerns about everything from the quality of service to patient care and other issues that they care about. They care about their work. They want their jobs to be good jobs.
We're talking to Kate Bronfenbrenner, who's the Director of Labor Education Research at Cornell. Joe Biden, I think, is probably the most pro-union president in my lifetime. And if not, he's in the top two or three. And obviously Congress is not a wildly pro-union bunch, needless to say. Are there things that he and his National Labor Relations Board unilaterally could do to change the playing field without Congress signing off?
Well, we just saw something like that yesterday.
What was that?
National Labor Relations Board issued a new joint employer standard. Some of the workers that suffer the most are those who are, contract employees or work for where there's multiple employers that oversee their working conditions and pay and benefits. And before this decision, if there were multiple employers, the ultimate employer was not responsible. Mm-hmm. You can think of McDonald's in this case. McDonald's has all these stores. And they were saying that they're not responsible for bargaining with the union and for the problems in those stores. This decision says that the union can bargain, they can bargain with that employer, and that they can't use joint employer status to avoid recognizing the union and bargaining with the union.
You know, Kate, one of the things I mentioned the other day, we were talking about, interesting that you mentioned this, we were talking to the guy who we talked to food issues about the California doing the sectoral bargaining thing around fast food kinds of deals. And we talked about the fact that the AFL-CIO finally has a woman president. And I would bet if you stopped 100 people in the street and said, who's Liz Schuler? About 100 of them would say, I have no idea who she is. Is there, I assume they understand, if we all do, that, as you said at the top, approval of labor unions is at a high in recent years. The percentage of people who would like to vote for a union in their workplace is at a high. Are they capitalizing upon this, or is it sort of the same head down, just deal with government officials kind of approach to union leadership?
Let's just say that we, in the first 6 months of this year, we had more workers organized than organized in the entire year before or years previously. So yes, organizing is happening, and it's not, it's not just workers organizing themselves, but it's unions getting out there and capitalizing on this. That doesn't mean it's not very hard in the current environment with the kind of employer opposition we have, but the public support and the worker enthusiasm is helping to spur, one workplace after another. Organizing is contagious. When workers see that one group was able to overcome the obstacles, they go, if they can do it, I can do it. And so it spreads. And then it's up to unions to take advantage of that and get out there and organize. But organized, they have to organize very creatively and effectively because you have employers who are, you know, who are going to fight this all the way to the top.
You know, I'm wondering if there's a growing understanding of the difference between private sector unions and public sector unions, because I have to admit I've been one that's given a hard time to some of the union rules, like on the MBTA here in Massachusetts, where people used to be able to retire after 20 years and get a full pension and stuff. Are people realizing more that, you know, there may be some good deals in public sector unions still, but it's a whole different story in the private sector unions? Is that part of what's going on?
There's a lot of variation depending on industry, and even with the public sector, there is. But, you know, if you try to organize in the public sector, the difference is that because of the Constitution, the way it applies to the public sector, workers, you know, unions have access. Employers can't deny workers the ability to speak about their conditions. They can't, often captive audience meetings have been found to be illegal in some states because they aren't giving the union equal time. And, you know, the workers can vote for their employers. So employers in electoral politics, employers feel a lot more pressure in the public sector not to engage in egregious, illegal anti-union behavior because the public does not like that. And there are sectors of the public sector where employers act more like private sector, and that's higher education and healthcare. They oppose unions a lot more aggressively, but still win rates in the public sector are above 95%. And that gives you an idea of how much easier it is to organize.
Yeah.
Kate, we only have 30 seconds left. Do a little Nostradamus. 5 years hence, 10 years hence, are the Amazons and the Starbucks and the one Trader Joe's in Western Mass going to trigger change, or is this going to be seen as a wonderful couple of years, but that's the end of it?
I'm very optimistic for one reason. The workers who are organizing at these workplaces are young.
That's a great point.
And because they're young, they're the future of the labor movement. They're coming into the labor movement. And even if they, you know, do have to leave the jobs they have now, their consciousness has been raised and they're going to go to other workplaces and organize.
Kate Bronfenberger, Brenner, we really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for your thoughts. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too.
Thank you very much for joining us. We've been speaking with Kate Bronfenbrenner. She's Director of Labor Education Research and a Senior Lecturer at Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations and Co-Director of the Worker Empowerment Research Project. Early in the show, we heard from Rafi, a local Starbucks barista and organizer with Starbucks Workers United. Coming up, we're going to talk with famed documentarians Ken Burns and Lynn Novak on their latest 6-hour special examining how Americans acted and didn't act when faced with the Nazi takeover abroad and the ultimate Holocaust that ensued. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, filmmakers Ken Burns and Lynn Novak have a new 3-part, 6-hour documentary all about where the U.S. stood and did not stand during the years of the Holocaust. They'll join us in studio with their takeaways on how racism, anti-Semitism, and white supremacy at home helped foster genocide abroad.
Then Democratic candidate for Attorney General Andrea Campbell joins us after last week's primary win. We'll ask her about her vision for working as the state attorney general, potentially alongside Governor Moore Healey. All that to come, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Marjorie Egan, welcome to hour number 2 of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. And we're live tomorrow at the Boston Public Library. Michelle Wu will join us. I think it's from 12 to 1 for Ask the Mayor. She'll take your calls and our questions. So in 1938, Americans were polled about their views of the persecution of Jews abroad. 2/3 of the population said they believed it was their own fault as the Nazis ascended to power. We're joined in studio by filmmakers Ken Burns and Lynn Novak, who, along with Sarah Botstein and a brilliant script from Jeff Ward, have put together a six-hour special, The U.S. and the Holocaust, examining, at least in part, how racism and anti-Semitism at home helped allow genocide abroad. Here is historian Daniel Green from the film.
We tell ourselves stories as a nation. One of the stories we tell ourselves is that we're a land of immigrants. But in moments of crisis, it becomes very hard for us to live up to those stories. I think the impetus should not then be to wag your finger at people in the past and think that we're somehow superior to them, but to struggle to understand why that's such a tension between having a humanitarian ideal and then living up to it on the ground.
The documentary airs on three nights starting September 18th on PBS. GBH and the Boston Symphony Orchestra are hosting an evening with Ken Burns, Lynn Novak, and Sarah Botstein tonight. That's at 7:30 at Symphony Hall. You can get tickets at bso.org. Ken and Lynn, it's great to see you both. Congratulations yet again.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for coming in here, and thank you for this great film. As I said before, we're not on the air. I'm always humiliated by everything I didn't know, and
Ditto.
I sure did not know a lot until I saw this film.
Ditto.
Oh, good. That makes me feel better.
No, no, because we're not doing, you know, telling you what we know.
Yeah.
We're sharing with you our process of discovery, and that's a big difference.
Well, I know you said in one of the interviews, Ken Burns, that this was not about the Trump era and build the wall and America
no.
First started before that. But when I was watching this, obviously it kind of hit me over the head that there certainly are some similarities on scale, no comparison, but just in the America First and the build the wall and the attitudes that we saw in your film.
So as Jim alluded to, you know, we're table setting this, and we have to set the background. This is the U.S. and the Holocaust. We're not responsible for the Holocaust. We have some reckoning to do about what we didn't do in the face of what we knew and we did know. But we needed to set a table that told about American anti-Semitism, American racism, xenophobia, nativism. You add eugenics and the depression to that, and you have a toxic brew that makes it super impossible to help get any Jews out of Europe. Even though the United States brought in 225,000 refugees, more than any other sovereign nation, we could have gotten in at least five times that many, if not 10, and I still would have said we would have failed. But as we've done any film, you always know it's going to resonate with the present, and our job is to ignore that and just focus. But because of that windup, we had to have a dismount that had to acknowledge that there are evidences. There is a moment in the film when the great Holocaust scholar Deborah Lipstadt says, the time to stop a genocide is before it happens. Let me amend that and just say, the time to save a democracy is before it's lost.
Well, you know, Lynn Novak, speaking of before it happens, let's talk about after it happens, too. One of the areas where I knew nothing, I mean, I knew we were not all in as an American people. I didn't know we were hardly in at all. And, you know, it's one thing, you know, my understanding of history, which was wrong, is the press wasn't reporting any of this stuff. FDR was this virulent anti-Semite. I mean, you mute that a lot. We'll talk about that in a minute. But not only are we not supportive as a people and clearly as a Congress, as this is all going on, even after it's demonstrated how real it was for the deniers, after the fact, we still don't want refugees coming to this country. Why?
That was such a bitter pill to swallow for all of us and for Sarah Botstein, our co-director on the film, and Ken and me, you know, to kind of come to terms with that exact reality was really tough to see that during the war, Americans had access to information, as Ken was saying. There was a lot of coverage of what Hitler was doing, and as the killings escalated, more and more information about it. But when 1945 came, the camps were liberated. The horrific images were seen, and Eisenhower insisted that the press came to see these horrors and to document them so it could never be denied. You know, there was no getting around the fact that this happened, this catastrophic, barbaric event unprecedented in human history probably happened. And then there were millions of people still left in Europe, displaced people, of which at least 200,000 were Jewish, who couldn't go home. There was no home left to go. Their homes had been taken over or destroyed. Their communities didn't exist. And we had this very strict quota system set up before all this happened in the 20s. And the American people, the polling was consistent that it's terrible what happened, but we don't want to let more people in. And really it was, you know, digging into why that is the case, is that's a big question that we're still trying to really wrap our minds around.
That's the voice of Lynn Novak. She, Ken Burns, Sarah Botstein, and others, The U.S. and the Holocaust, airs beginning September 18th. Again, they are tonight at Symphony Hall, an evening with them. You can get tickets at bso.org.
You know, I think at Ken Burns, a lot of people knew about Charles Lindbergh and his big America First committee and all that, and that I didn't know FDR viewed him as a Nazi. But there were other people that you talked about that I did not know had these virulent, both anti-Semitic and anti-immigrant views. Tell us about some of those people.
Well, one of them is the famous Detroit radio priest, the Catholic Father Coughlin, who had a radio audience in the millions, who was just out and out anti-Semitic. And even after he was kind of cashiered and out of his job, his leagues that he had started were, it's sad to say for our community, they were still attacking Jewish kids. And Irish cops in Boston and New York were standing by and letting that go off. Perhaps besides Lindbergh, the biggest figure in this tragedy is Henry Ford, who is a virulent anti-Semite. He believes that Jews are somehow responsible for the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. He buys the Dearborn Independent. He turns it into the second highest circulation newspaper in the country, and they promulgate the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is a 19th century Russian hoax, which is one of the most virulently anti-Semitic tracts ever written. And he sort of gives it new life again and sort of puts it out there as the facts. And so what you have is an American public that's sort of been brainwashed, or a large segment of the American public that's brainwashed by their hero, the aviator, by this radio priest, by Henry Ford and others, and by a kind of just basic anti-Semitism, which is not just American. It's millennia old and has been going on.
And the Jim Crow laws that the Nazis seem to have studied. Tell us about that, Lynn Novak.
Yeah, so this is another thing that we really were struck by, which was that, you know, when Hitler and the Nazis were trying to develop a way to persecute the Jews that would seem legal and kind of proper at first, they came to the U.S. and studied our Jim Crow laws. How do you do this? What kind of laws do you pass? How do you get people to go along with it? How do you define the person that you're trying to persecute? So in America, many southern states had the one drop rule. One drop of so-called, what they said, Negro blood meant that you were considered African-American and therefore a second-class citizen. The Germans actually thought that was a little bit too strict, and they came up with a whole other complicated system of sort of dividing people, you know, what made somebody Jewish and therefore subject to being their rights taken away. But, you know, the thing is, in the bigger picture, that Hitler admired, and the Nazis, what America had done to set up this system of second-class citizenship. And that was really a problem for the U.S. Whenever we tried to criticize the Nazis for what they were doing, they would just push it back in our faces and say, well, you do the same. You know, you think what we're doing is bad. What about what you're doing in Mississippi? And I'm not sure what would be the good answer to that one.
So, Ken Burns, I watched this film. I feel better about FDR and worse about Teddy Roosevelt. So
that's always a good position to be in.
Can we start with Teddy and explain why I feel that way and then deal with the FDR issue?
Look, can we set aside all of the aspects of TR's, you know, warmongering, you know, stuff. He's a proponent of a pseudoscience called eugenics, which adds to the toxic brew that is sort of insists that it is possible to categorize races and ethnicities and create a hierarchy, which is, of course, an unabashed fiction. There's one race. It's the human race. So TR is very much a proponent of this, which includes sterilization of people. And to hear Helen Keller also support
Helen
this.
Keller! Yeah. I know that.
That was brutal. Yeah.
Yeah, we were texting each other at that point in the movie, but go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's really tough to take. So the trope is that somehow FDR has been turned into the villain. And we understand that why that is. You need a kind of bold-faced name to equalize the bold-faced name of Hitler, right? So you got to assume that the reason why it happened is because FDR didn't do something. But FDR is not the king. He's not the Führer. He's got the Johnson Reed, the 1924 Johnson Reed Immigration Act, which has these pernicious quotas that only allows people from the Nordic, Northern Europeans, and it limits specifically those countries that have large populations of Jews without mentioning the word Jews or Catholics or things like that. So, you know, he's operating under a system. He can't take in the St. Louis because the laws won't let him to do that. He seems on the outset a little bit distant, and I think we hold his feet to the fire at that place where political calculation. But as one of our scholars, Peter Hay, says, that when we look back, we think absolutely the humanitarian question should be foremost, but he's trying to revoke the Neutrality Acts. And if the Neutrality Acts had not been revoked, we'd think differently, or we might be speaking German. Yeah. Right, I'm not kidding. And so, there's a thing in which Roosevelt can be criticized, but the pure anti-Semites of the time called him Frank D. Rosenfeld. They called his political program the Jew Deal, and that ought to be the signal for everybody who wants to try to demonize FDR. But here's the real important thing: it's just like with the conspiracies with American assassinations, the assassin is nowhere near the level of a JFK, so you have to invent or make or find or discover big conspiracies. Sirhan Sirhan is not RFK. All of these different things that happened. But here, our film is called The U.S. capital U, period, capital S, and the Holocaust. But this is also us in the Holocaust. The failure is in every place. It's in the administration, particularly with implacable, hidebound anti-Semites in the State Department. It's in the Congress. But they are representing the will, as we've just been saying, of the American people. So we are – this is a reckoning that we have to have about the kind of people. Are we a nation of immigrants? Absolutely. Are we also a nation absolutely committed to not letting immigrants in? We are also that too. And we have to be able to figure out a container, in this case a sort of story of us, the U.S., that can – hold these contradictory places without throwing the baby out with the bathwater, without investing entirely with revisionism, but certainly not investing in the exceptional, sanitized Madison Avenue view of us.
You know, by the way, just a personal note, I'm looking at Ken Burns and Lynn Novick here. You and I are complaining every day before the show. We have 7 segments to do. How are we going to get through with this workload? These guys are turning out like 6-hour documentaries, yeah. Practically. Weekly.
Nonstop.
But you know, go ahead.
Oh, no, you go ahead.
Well, one thing you guys did, Lynn, that has been done before, but for some reason, maybe it's your skills, it had a much more profound impact on me. Large numbers, while you nod your head, I mean, for example, you guys do the mandatory 1933, 9 million Jews in Europe, 1945, I think it was, 3 million, 2/3 were exterminated. And obviously every decent soul nods their head like, what a horror. But you relentlessly in this film go back to the fact it's not a 6 million figure, it's 6 million people. Millions of families. And let's just play sound from one of them and talk about that. Does Eva's Geiringer or Geiringer?
Mm-hmm.
Geiringer. Here's Eva Geiringer. She was 8 years old when the Nazis came to Vienna and her family immediately sought an exit visa. Here she is.
I didn't want to leave. I know it didn't feel nice anymore. But still, I had my relatives there and it was my language and I loved it there. And my parents said, well, it won't be long, and, we'll go back again. That people, even in 38, didn't believe that Hitler will be able to stay in power for very long.
And correct me if I'm wrong, she had Anne Frank as a friend, right, when she
yes.
was a kid. Tell us a little bit about Eva and her family.
So Sarah Botstein, our partner, did a beautiful interview with Eva, and she was very generous to share her story with us, as are several of the other witnesses, survivors of this time. She grew up, as you just heard, in Vienna. The family escaped and went to Amsterdam, mm-hmm. and they happened to live in the same neighborhood as the Frank family. And we follow the story of Anne Frank's family in the film. We weren't expecting to do that when we started the project, but it came to our attention that they had tried to come to America.
Yeah.
And so that helped us kind of key into, for us as Americans, as Ken was saying, what's our connection? Anne Frank could have come here if our doors were open. So Eva sort of, in a way, represents that story of what might have been. And she shared a really harrowing saga, tragedy of what happened to her family She and her family went into hiding like the Franks did, and then ultimately they were deported, as were the Franks, to Auschwitz, separated men and women. She went with her mother, Eva with her mother, and never saw her father and brother again. And, you know, she kind of bears witness to the particularities, as Daniel Mendelsohn, the writer, says in our film, of what families went through and the loss they still carry to this day.
Mention, though, I mean, I don't know if it's a happy note. We're going to talk about some of the heroes in a minute. Mm-hmm. But mention the connection between her mother and Otto Frank and Frank's father.
So after Auschwitz was liberated by the Russians in the winter of 1945, she and her mother had basically just barely survived, and she went out into the snow to try to find her father and brother in the men's section of the camp. And she didn't find them, but she did find this man that she sort of recognized, and she realized it was Otto Frank, who she had known from Amsterdam. And they sort of, you know, bound together and went through the next few years together, sort of being taken by the Russians to Odessa and then going back to Amsterdam. And over time, her mother and Otto Frank formed a really incredible bond and were married. And so Otto Frank was her stepfather.
And she
it's really something. And, you know, for us, she, I mean, to hear her talk about Anne Frank as a little girl, you know, they played together. Geez. They knew each other. She, Anne Frank, was very vivacious and interested in boys and wanted to know her brother. And, you know, it just makes her, gives her a third dimension.
And that's the point of the whole thing, which is, how do you particularize in Daniel Mendelsohn's the lives that are lost? You know, President Biden yesterday was talking about the people we lost on 9/11, right? And these precious beings. Well, you know, we've got nearly 3,000 Americans who died 21 years ago yesterday. We're talking about 6 million people, and most of them are anonymous. And we don't know what cures we missed getting, what symphonies weren't written, what gardens weren't tended, what children weren't raised with love. And it's that amputated limb, that missing part, that we were insistent on trying to say. 6 million, Jim, as you're saying, it's opaque. It means nothing. But if you can particularize individuals in it, like Daniel Mendelsohn did of his great uncle Shmuel Yeager in a small provincial eastern Polish town, and his wife and four daughters, only one of whom dies by gas, which is what we just automatically, we flip that switch, we think that's what happens. And so by understanding them, and you see these heartfelt letters from people saying, writing to friends, knowing they're about to die, I just want the world to know that someone named David Berger lived.
Yeah. Oh,
and this kind of existential stuff, we abstract everything. You know, I remember in the Civil War, people would say, well, slavery would have died out in a generation and a half. And you want to go, okay, you want to try that on for a generation and a half? Or how about a decade? Or how about a year? No? How about a week? No? A day? An hour? Well, then you're just, it's pornography, right? It's just, we have to remember that the things that we abstract are more often than not human beings suffering in a way that we cannot possibly imagine.
We're talking to filmmakers Ken Burns and Lynn Novak. Their latest six-hour special, The U.S. and the Holocaust, is going to air starting September 18th on PBS. The other thing that reminded me, when you talk about, you know, democracy is the best way to save it is before it starts to go, the incrementalism of this, and you know, as that young girl, just little girl, Eva said when she was eight, she thought she was going to be back.
Right.
Or somebody else, I forget who said it, but someone said, we couldn't believe it was happening to us. So it wasn't so surprising that other people couldn't believe what was happening to us. Mm-hmm. And that came home to me very. Talk about that. People not thinking, as she just said, that Hitler could be in power forever, or is that this, we could wind up in Auschwitz.
Yeah, when you're in the middle of a catastrophe that's incrementally happening, it is very hard. And there has been over the years, you know, people, I think this is less true now, you know, blaming Jewish people for not getting out. Didn't they know what was going to happen? First of all, it was not that easy to get out. And second of all, no, they didn't know what was going to happen. And, you know, that is where I think we're not saying that the same thing is happening in our world today, but that we're living in very perilous times. And all around us, we're aware of the fragility of our democracy, the threat to our election process, the mainstreaming of hate speech, and the bigotry that's all around us, and the demonization of immigrants. You know, these are all things that there's a playbook here. And the film, the echoes, as we say a lot, just kept getting louder and louder while we were working on it. So I think in a way it's easier now for us to understand what it was like then because of the world we're living in right now.
Yeah, I mean, the parallels are kind of very unnerving.
You know, we've been doing this for many decades, and we're always aware of the fact that the rhymes, as Mark Twain says, you know, are going to happen. And it's important for us to diligently ignore them, acknowledge them to ourselves, but we're not writing to them. We're not pointing big arrows or neon signs saying, oh, isn't this like today? But in this film, because of our approach, our dismount has to say, you know, there are elements of this. We actually were intending this film to come out next year, but we just felt a kind of urgency of now, as Dr. King said, that we had to just bring it out and let it out and be part of the conversation. Stories do a better job than arguments of changing people, whether it's at the edges, in the middle, subtly, unconsciously. And you know that if you tell a good story, something gets rearranged in somebody else. It may not manifest itself right away in the most, obstructionist person, but you have the possibility of reaching them in a way, us telling them you're wrong, you know, that you voted for the wrong person, you don't understand this. Nobody likes to be told that, anybody. And so if you tell a complicated story, yeah, you'll bring out the deniers, yeah, you'll bring out the haters, but the more important thing is that if it's a good story, you get lost in it, and it's finally irrefutable. Did this happen? Yes, it did. Are we right to say never again? Yes, we are. And what do we do? What is our responsibility to make sure that it never happens again? And a lot of it is to, particularly now that these survivors aren't going to be around that much longer, right? And while Spielberg and Shoah has collected 54,000 and there are several hundred holographic representations of people, including Eva Geiringer answering our questions, as many questions as we could possibly imagine for kids, it's really important that we help them bear witness again to what took place. And new information comes out. We locked this film and then we unlocked it 150 times. To just add one little thing or to pull out an adjective or to qualify something with a perhaps. But it was interesting. You know, we want this to be as absolutely accurate as we can so that you cannot begin to deny that this what happened.
You know, by the way, we started today's show asking listeners why are we as a people much more interested in day after day, 24/7, of Queen Elizabeth, and nobody gives a damn about what's happening in Ukraine, which is obviously on a whole different scale. But nevertheless, can we spend a couple of minutes with the heroes or the happy stories?
Yeah.
Let's do what's your line to me all the time, the dreaded Localango.
The dreaded Localango.
Marjorie and I, when we started in the radio about 400 years ago, would say, we don't elect any women to Congress from Massachusetts. And we always ask listeners, can you name the one woman ever elected to Congress from
Edith
Massachusetts?
Edith Norse Rogers.
You win, Mr. Burns. You get one.
Yeah.
What did Edith Norse Rogers? You get the fuck. We left $5 on the thing. You can keep it. We'll throw in another $5 because you've really been good today, by the way. Okay, so what did Edith Norse Rogers do, Ken Burns?
I'm giving a nod as a woman. I think I have to take this one.
Yes, you have to. Lynn has to do this.
You know, this was another one of these very complicated stories in the film and in the history, is that after Kristallnacht, which was the really sort of violent and worldwide news headlines of what the Germans were doing to persecute the Jews in Germany, attacking people, killing them, burning down their houses, etc., and the reaction to that, and there was quite a worldwide reaction, there was a bill introduced in Congress called the Wagner-Rogers Act, sponsored by Robert Wagner of New York and Edith Norse Rogers of Massachusetts, to let in 20,000 children, not using the quota system that had been set up that Ken was talking about, so 10,000 in 1939 and 10,000 in 1940. And the UK had something called the Kinder Transport that we might be familiar with, where they were admitting, I think, 10 or 20,000 children as refugees. And this bill was debated in Congress. Eleanor Roosevelt supported it. The president didn't say anything publicly, but he seemingly supported it behind the scenes. But as Deborah Lipstadt, the historian, says in our film, the anti-Semites came out of the woodwork and basically used the American Legion, the Daughters of the American Revolution, many other quote-unquote patriotic groups came out viciously against it. And, you know, saying things like 10,000 children will grow into 10,000 ugly adults. So, you know, we don't want these people here. Because if we open the door a little bit, more of them will come, and we don't want them. They shouldn't be part of our society. These are Jewish children fleeing Hitler, right? We don't want them. And in the end, the heroes that introduced the bill had to withdraw it. It never came to a vote because they realized that if it did come to a vote and was voted down, which it would have been, it would have provoked more anti-immigrant legislation. Congress would have actually used it as an excuse to say, not only do we not want these 20,000 children, we are shutting off all immigration right now. And that's, you know, that was the calculus to basically not even have a vote on this bill.
What about the idea of all these, or at least some of these Jewish people, as spies? I mean, that I didn't know about either.
Yeah, so that what happens is just at that moment where there is a kind of public relations transfer, like people are beginning to realize, oh, this is really happening and this is not a good thing. They're the Jews, they're people, we don't like this. We're American people, we believe in fairness, you know, this is not a good thing. But then at the same time, there's a worry based on real stuff that there are all these fifth columnists, people who are attacking us from within, Nazi agents. And of course, what that means is that every Jewish immigrant would be a Nazi spy. And of course, this makes no sense. And Deborah Lipstadt says, you know, the worst spy in the world is somebody with thick accent that doesn't know anything about where they're going. They just want to get out of there. But does this stop people from FDR on down sort of believing this fearfulness and it's happening? And there was fifth column activity during World War I, real sabotage. There was in World War II. There was a network of Nazi spies in the United States, but they weren't the Jewish immigrants that everybody then said, well, then we can't. So just at the moment when you sort of feel like public opinion might be tipping and you might get somewhere with this appeal of letting people in, all of a sudden the public opinion becomes, we've got to close the door. So if you're being charitable, you could say, well, it's the middle of the Depression. Of course, you're not going to want to let anybody else in because they're going to take food off your table. They might take your job, all the stuff that the authoritarians try to revive in you. But once you got to the place where you were feeling some sympathy for these people, for the victims of Hitler's, you know, mad regime, to just have this come in at the last moment and say, oh, but you know what? You could be a spy. So we're going to hold you out. It feels so cruel. And so it's you know, it's stealing the ball from Charlie Brown again. You know, it's just pulling the rug out from under.
Did I interrupt the hero discussion? There were a few more heroes.
You should watch the film.
Yeah, there's lots of points of light in this.
There are.
And also that we weren't the only country that was doing this. The Europeans weren't that great either.
No. This is the U.S. and the Holocaust. We don't go into the Pope and we don't go into British anti-Semitism and we don't do this and don't do that. But we took in more people than any other sovereign nation. It wasn't enough. It's a failure, as far as I'm concerned. But you know, we're not alone in anti-Semitism, racism, nativism, and xenophobic feelings. You know.
You know, Lynn and Ken, before you go, when you're doing something like this that is this heavy, when you're in the midst of it, are you able to just keep plowing through it, or do you have to take breaks from? Do you know what I mean? I mean, some of this stuff is so overwhelmingly painful. Particularly the personal stories are just, do you stop or do you talk? What do you do to keep going? Do you know what I mean? I don't know if I'm articulating that well.
That experience is not unique to this project because we've dealt with some other very dark, tragic stories, the Vietnam War and World War II, and Ken has many other also tragic projects, that Civil War certainly. But, you know, I think it's, you do have to try to be fully present. That's what we really try to do with our interview subjects, with each other, with our writer, Jeff Ward, with our editors, and to just recognize that we're dealing with very difficult material, especially, I feel, for our editors who have to look at the horrific images over and over again. We don't show a lot in this film, but the little bit that we do show, you know, or even doing the research. So you're collecting photographs of atrocities just to figure out which ones we're going to use. And, you know, for our younger staff, some of our amazing producers and researchers, I do get concerned for them that they open up their computer and they pull in a file and you're looking at something that you really wish you didn't have to look at. So I think we just try to be mindful of that, be respectful, and to try to take care of each other. And that's the best we can do. And also to, you know, have a lot of humility about this, that we're dealing with a tragedy on a scale that we can't really fathom. And, you know, to just always be mindful of that.
Yeah, how about you, Ken Burns?
Yeah, I don't think we take breaks. We do a lot of crying and we try to feel it. deeply, and there's, as Lynn is suggesting, there's a kind of calibration that's going on. You've got the 6.5 hours, we've got the 600 hours, which means we're looking at the really bad stuff and saying, you know, we don't need to do this. There's, we don't have to have war pornography in this film. We need to pull out a few fuel rods. We will be able to communicate our story a little bit better. And so what keeps us going is that idea of what makes a better story, and do we put our heads on our pillows at the end of the day, regardless of what we've seen or how bad it was or how many nightmares we're about to have about it, and have made the film a little bit better.
Well, the film is huge and really an important moment, I think, for everybody in this country, and we are thrilled to have you. Thank you both for your time.
Yeah, great to talk to you again, and thank you for all your amazing, amazing work.
And by the way, you were, keep the $5. I mean, you were really, you really hit a home run today. You know what I mean?
Well, it's nice to be back in person.
Yeah, it's good to see you.
It is nice to be back in person. Like, instead of our life on Zoom,
we're
all so tired of it.
In all seriousness, really terrific.
Thank you.
Really important. Thank you both.
So I'm
wondering. And your colleagues.
Thank you.
Okay, we've been speaking with filmmakers Ken Burns and Lynn Novak, their latest 6-hour special, as I said before, the U.S. and the Holocaust examines the rise of Hitler and Nazism in Germany through the lens of global anti-Semitism and American racism. It airs September 18th. However, there is also another great event. At the Boston Symphony Orchestra is hosting this. The Evening with Ken Burns, Lynn Novak, and Sarah Botstein is tonight, 7:30, Symphony Hall. And there are still a few tickets left if you want to try to get them at BSO.org. Thank you again so much for coming in.
Ken and Lynn, see you soon.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to talk to former City Councilor Andrea Campbell, has emerged as a Democratic nominee for Attorney General. We'll hear from her off her primary win last week and what's going to happen in the race ahead. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. I think we're about to talk to Andrea Campbell. She's here, right? Oh, she's there where?
Is she on Zoom, maybe?
I'm sorry. I'm a little confused here. My apologies. Is she physically here?
Oh, she's in our ears.
Oh, she's in our ears. Sorry. Oh. I thought she was here.
We're looking all over the place.
Oh, my God.
Is she under the desk? Is she out in the hallway?
In any case, former City
Councilor.
Hey there. Okay. Former City Councilor Andrea Campbell is now the Democratic nominee for Attorney General. Hi, Andrea Campbell. Good to talk to you.
Same here. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. So congratulations, Andrea Campbell, and thank you so much. We're sorry you're not here in person, but eventually we'll see you again in person.
Great.
So how'd you pull this off? All we heard in the later days of the campaign is you were getting outspent by millions of dollars. How'd you win?
We did the work. You know, at the end of the day, it was about making sure that we weren't taking anything or anyone for granted. We got out there. We crisscrossed the state several times. We listened to people, we talked to them, and then in clear terms, told them what an attorney general can do to help them with the issues they're grappling with every single day. And of course, honored with the results, and now on to November.
You know, Andrea Campbell, the only thing that I heard you say in this campaign that I had a hard time believing, I don't know who you were being interviewed by, when you said, I hadn't thought, when an interviewer said to you, do you know that if you win this nomination, it would be the first black woman nominated by a major party, by voters, for statewide constitutional office? And I think you said, correct me if I'm wrong, I hadn't thought of that before. Are you kidding me? You hadn't thought of that before?
No, I will tell you, as most folks who know me well, I'm a faith-driven praying woman. And, you know, after the mayor's race, went to a space of, okay, what is next? And had a lot of opportunities. And this one, I felt sort of found me, obviously, with Governor Baker not running and more deciding to run, and thought deeply about what I could do in the job, particularly on criminal legal reform, racial justice and injustice, and just helping the average resident who feels left out and left behind. So when we launched the campaign, it had never crossed my mind.
Whoa.
How historic this was, until literally a reporter asked one of my comms folks, would this be the first, if Andrea were to win, the first woman of color to lead the office and to win a statewide campaign. And of course, in that first week, it did hit me, and I understand the magnitude of it. And so it's an incredible honor to be the nominee for the Democratic Party.
We're talking to Andrea Campbell.
So, Andrea Campbell, what do you see as your priorities as the Attorney General of the Commonwealth? What really matters to you most?
What matters to the voters? And as I crisscross this state, what has come up and quite a bit is major concern around, one, mental health. I don't think we've ever really prioritized those issues in the way that we should. There is an epidemic, not just in the context of adults, but also young people as well. And it's existed for decades nationally and in the state. There's a lot the office can do to address that and couple that with the opioid crisis and drug abuse. In addition, I think everything having to do with racial disparities that exist in every system, there is obviously an expectation that I would take those issues on, and I would, along with using other lenses in the office, a disability lens, one affecting the LGBTQ plus community. And I will say people just worried about whether or not they're going to be able to thrive and prosper coming out of COVID. Price gouging, inflation, wages, just basic economic prosperity reaching folks outside of Boston. And of course, in those pockets of the city of Boston that feel left out, left behind, major issues as well. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention community violence and gun violence. Just a few minutes ago, got word that in my former council district, a student was stabbed at their school, their high school, the Burke High School in Dorchester. So there are a lot of communities still addressing community violence, and there's absolutely a lot the office can do in terms of gun enforcement and so much more.
You know, the Globe editorial endorsing, I'll read the first line. The next state attorney general will step in to lead the nationally respected office amid a host of urgent challenges. And here's the first one they list: an increasingly unreliable public transit system, woefully lacking in accountability. What can an attorney general do to address that first item in the Globe editorial endorsing you?
In terms of transportation, I think there's a lot. One thing I've been speaking about is obviously Maura Healey endorsed me in the race. And I think it's a partnership that the Commonwealth in Massachusetts should be proud of. Obviously, a governor and attorney general can do a lot together. And of course, along with the other elected other statewide offices. Mm-hmm. One is just pushing for greater investment. Obviously, President Biden is here in Boston speaking as we're speaking on greater federal resources coming to the state to invest in that infrastructure. But I think accountability is critical, and I think an AG can play a role in pushing for greater transparency. When folks are talking about various plans, whether it's the fiscal board or others, making sure that folks know publicly what those plans are and hold the T accountable for reaching all types of goals, including diversity requirements when it comes to procurement. They haven't done that. And I remember, you know, being an attorney for Governor Deval Patrick, they still are missing the mark on some of those issues. And these, of course, are opportunities to grow businesses owned by women and people of color.
You know, Andrea Campbell, Michelle Wu, your former colleague on the council, and Senator Warren didn't just endorse one of your opponents, Shannon Liz Reardon. They relentlessly campaigned for your opponent. What was your reaction to that? And what's the after effect of that connection to not only an endorsement of Liz Reardon, but a conscious decision not to endorse you?
As I said to both of them, of course, I was disappointed. But I told my team, don't get distracted. The end of the day for me, it was always about going to talk to the people on the ground, listening to them directly about the issues they cared about the most, talking about what distinguished me from the other candidates in the race, and what I would do as Attorney General to help them. And that's why I'm really proud of the campaign we ran. It's one of hope, optimism, possibility that centers the people and really speak specifically as to what that office can do to help them. And that's what resonated. That message resonated all across the state. And now we have to get out here, of course, all the way through November to make sure we continue to earn the support of residents across the Commonwealth.
There's no truth to the rumor that you're planning on indicting either of them. Is that true, Andrea Campbell? You know,
first I have to first get there.
Okay, and then you decide. Course, fine.
That is the priority, and then the hard work begins.
You know, but on a serious note, I know you said all the right things that, you know, we just got to focus on our job, etc. You served with Wu on the city council. History could be made in this race. And Joan Vernocchi's column was that this is all about revenge, that you endorsed Kamala Harris rather than Warren, that you didn't endorse Wu after you lost in the preliminary. Will this not affect in some ways your relationship with both of them should you be elected?
I've always led in a way that I don't make it personal. And part of that is maybe it's my faith walk, as Mom says, which is very hard. Mom always reminds me of that, you know, be like Jesus. So what would Jesus do? That's very hard. And so for me, don't take things personally. It is about the work. And I think what we're seeing in Washington, D.C. or other places across the country, the divisiveness, leadership, their inability to get things done that will actually help people move the needle on issues. That's what residents want. They want us to focus on the work. They want us to get things done. I don't engage in the petty or revenge or the politics of things. Mm-hmm. For me, it is about getting out, meeting people where they are, being as inclusive as possible, because there are so many folks that feel left out of the political systems, that whether people of color, low-income residents, folks living in our rural communities, Central and Western Mass as well, those in the disability community, the LGBTQ plus community. Our job was to engage all of those communities to say, I see you, I want to work on behalf of you and make sure these systems are responsive to your needs. And that's what we're going to have to continue to do all the way through November.
You know, Jim McMahon is your Republican opponent. He is a supporter of former President Donald Trump. What are your plans for debates?
I don't know yet. We'll obviously be... We'll continue to get out there. We haven't been in contact. I will tell you, I saw Jay in Worcester. We already had a debate. It didn't get much media attention, but we were at a college in Worcester. All four candidates for AG showed up, including Jay. I think it went well, because afterwards, at the end, he said, that was wonderful. You were excellent. I said, thank you, Jay. and then continued to go about the work. And so I think there are already major distinctions between me and the Republican candidate in this race. Some of that is can be viewed in that recent debate, which is recorded by the college, and folks should take a look. At the end of the day, it's about making sure we're protecting access to reproductive rights, protecting our democratic principles and institutions, and standing up for folks and the values we represent. And right now, I know the Democratic Party is the best to deliver on that. And I know my candidacy is the best in this moment in time to also deliver for every resident across the state.
But Andrea Campbell, I just want to be clear. Other than that four-way before the primaries, are you committed to debating Mr. McMahon between now and the head-to-head between now and Election Day?
We'll see. I'm not opposed to it. Right now, I think we'll have conversations. I will tell you this. My priority, though, is one to thank all of my supporters who mobilized and did the work. And then to get out there in communities where we weren't able to spend as much time, including getting back to Central and Western Mass, getting back into rural communities and more communities that we were unable to get to. That's my priority.
Aren't you? I have to say, I'm a little surprised. Don't you think the voters are entitled to see a head-to-head between every Democrat and every Republican running for statewide office in addition to whatever work all the candidates do with voters directly?
So I have never shied away from a debate. I only spoke to the debate we just had because there was one, a real debate that was an hour long where no one actually saw it because sadly there was no coverage of it. But the college, God bless them, did a wonderful job. It was a real debate with real moderators, also run by the Worcester Bar Association, and where you can see the major distinctions between me and my Republican nominee. And that only happened, I think, maybe less than a month ago.
Well, I wouldn't have done this, but to be concrete, if we invite you to do a debate with Mr. McMahon, will you accept?
We'll see.
Okay, we're talking to Andrea Campbell.
So, Andrea Campbell, I think I saw at least one, if not two, children in your television ads that were adorable little kids. How old are your kids, and do they have any idea what it means for their mother to be the attorney general, should you prevail?
A little bit, not much. Alexander and Aiden. So Alexander just went off to school today, K-2, and he's five.
Wow.
And Aiden's two. He'll be three in December. Mm-hmm. They know a little bit. Alexander probably a little bit more, but not the magnitude or scope of the job.
Yeah.
But they know their mama is a public servant and one dedicated to living a purpose-driven life. that gives back to others. And that is something my husband and I want to model for them and to go after their dreams. And that it should always involve and include service to others.
Well, I bet they like that office. Doesn't Maura Healey have a great office down there? Isn't it way up high in one of the buildings like that, Andrea Campbell? I think so, right?
Well, I will say this. It has been amazing to get out on the trail, of course, to engage with some folks who are already doing the work in the office. Because at the end of the day, what I said was this work was about breaking cycles of poverty and trauma and incarceration, which I've done for my two boys, including being a first-time homeowner in Mattapan. Other families want access to the same opportunities, and there is a role that government can play to remove barriers for folks to have a level playing field and to ensure they have access to the same opportunities for their families and the next generation to come.
Andrea Campbell, we really appreciate your time and congratulations on your victory last week.
Thank you very much for joining with us, and congrats from me too, Andrea Campbell. Great to talk to you.
Thank you, and on to November, and hope to see you guys soon, maybe in the library.
Absolutely. We do too. That'd be great.
That was, of course, the voice of Andrea Campbell. She's a Democratic nominee for Attorney General coming up.
And we have an invitation out to Ms. McMahon to join us as well,
Yes, we do. Coming up, we are revisiting our conversation with New Yorker correspondent Jelani Cobb on how he positioned the Kerner Commission report in today's political context. You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're replaying some of our favorite conversations, like the one we had with New Yorker correspondent Jelani Cobb, who, by the way, since has been appointed dean of the Columbia School of Journalism. Our discussion was how he positioned the Kerner Commission report in today's political context. Jelani Cobb, it's good to talk to you again.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for being with us. So for people that don't know or don't remember, Jelani, give us a sense of what the Kerner Report said.
So the Kerner Report was the response of the LBJ administration to a spate of what they called, in very bureaucratic language, civil disturbances. But what other people called riots, uprisings, rebellions, in the language of that moment. And what set this report apart from dozens of other examinations of these issues was the fact that it, with no ambiguity whatsoever, indicted white America for the creation and maintenance of what they called the ghetto, terminology that was in the parlance then. That was in very stark language, very stark terms. And that was a bridge too far for the Johnson administration. The report was shelved and received virtually no attention from the president who created the commission. But oddly enough, or ironically, it ensured that the report would endure as a kind of public document. It reached the New York Times bestseller list. There were copies flying off the shelves. And even a half century later, there's still many people who remember that report, which you can't say for most government reports 6 months after they were released.
Well, and since most government reports get filed away and don't really say anything, the most notable line, among many notable lines, is the nation is moving towards two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. Jelani, despite what you said, in putting together this editing of the Kerner Commission report, did you find widespread knowledge about its contents? When you were on TV with me the other night, I admitted ignorance. I, of course, had heard of the report. I knew a little bit about it. But as I said to you, I learned a hell of a lot more than I knew going in. Was I that aberrational in 2021?
Well, it depends. There are people who are familiar, people who remember it. That's been one of the interesting things since this book has come out. I've had conversations with people who remember when the book came out, when the report came out, and what their reaction to it was. And so there are people who know. But certainly for people who are younger, people who are maybe 35 and under, this document doesn't have nearly that kind of resonance. And so, we were happy to be able to recommit to that conversation or refresh the memories of people who were around when the document came out or have, you know, read it in college and so on, and really happy to be able to introduce it to a younger generation of people.
Well, you know what I always found interesting is that many people may not have known that much about the Kerner Report or may have forgotten it because it's touching on white America's responsibility for a lot of the situations African-Americans were living in. But everybody seemed to remember what Daniel Patrick Moynihan had to say about black families, yeah. Jelani. Tell people that in case they've forgotten. I've heard that repeated dozens and dozens of times.
Sure. I mean, the Moynihan Report, which was, you know, possibly the most widely denounced report of that era, and you know, a decade, more than a decade later, there were still academics taking issue with it. But it was an examination of the Black family, or as they called it, the Negro family. And it began with a kind of liberal impulse. You know, Moynihan said that he was making a case for, you know, reform or a case for changing policy as it related to Black families in ways that would help them. But the route that he took to making that case has been widely derided. You know, it said that that households most controversially and most notably that households were defined by matriarchies, that Black men were essentially emasculated twice, once in the marketplace and labor market, and once in the household, because the pathology, and they do use the term pathology, yeah. Yeah, the pathology of Black families lies in them being female-headed as opposed to being male-headed. And I mean, it's shot through with all sorts of presumptions. It's certainly a very racist document, but you know, one of the things that it overlooked was the ways in which it was very thoroughly patriarchal and sexist, and implicitly making case a statement about the status of white women in America, yes. as well, which is one of the things that people were less likely to talk about than the very obvious and damning point that he made about Black families.
We're talking to Jelani Cobb. He is behind the Essential Kerner Commission Report, the landmark study on race inequality and police violence. You know, what one of the things, obviously, it sets apart the Kerner Commission Report is its unvarnished honesty. But the other thing is sort of its holistic approach to the problem. I have to say, when you were being relatively kind to me a minute ago, saying it's for young people who didn't know about it, my recollections were, having read some of it at the time, was it was about police brutality, which it is in part, and we'll get to that in a couple mm-hmm. of minutes. But could you describe, I guess the term I used a minute ago, I don't know if it's appropriate, the more holistic approach, the broader a take on systemic racism that the Kerner Commission took well beyond police behavior, Jelani Cobb?
So what is really interesting, you know, because the Kerner Commission report pointed out something that I found when I was reporting in Ferguson. When I went to Ferguson, this was after the death of Michael Brown, who was the 18-year-old young man who was shot fatally by a police officer, and you know, sparked months, really years of tension and outrage in the communities there. When the governor came, I expected there to be a lot of conversation about what happened, police policy, and so on. And that was the case, but it was mixed in with questions about housing, questions mm-hmm. about the quality or lack of quality of the roads there, questions about employment and the dearth of employment opportunities, questions about the overall education system. And I realized that the concern with Michael Brown was part of a bigger constellation of concerns that people had. And the Kerner Commission report said essentially the same thing, that when you've seen these riots, these uprisings, they've been almost uniformly in response to an act of police violence. But the police violence is simply the thing that ignites a pile of kindling that was already ready to go up. And those issues are, you know, only heightened and made more flammable by the education system, unemployment, lack of healthcare, media, which they also pointed out. It really is holistic, and to use your term, in its examination of why communities felt the way that they felt and what led to the uprisings we saw.
I think we should discuss the media thing in a second, but, you know, we most of us believe that one of the savviest presidents, at least on the domestic front, politically, was LBJ. He commissioned this report and then totally ignored it. How did he? And by the way, we should mention there's a local angle here. Ed Brooke, United States yeah. Senator, only black in the Senate at the time, was obviously, not obviously, but was a member of this commission. How did he so miscalculate what it was going to do? What did he expect to get? Another one of those typical government reports like you talked about?
Well, there are only two black guys. Maybe he thought they'd be overwhelmed by the rest of the guys that were white.
How is he so off here? How did he so miscalculate?
You know, it's funny. I raised that same question with Fred Harris, Senator Fred Harris, who is the last surviving member of the commission. He was in Oklahoma, served 8 years in the United States Senate representing Oklahoma. And he said that they went through almost every major finding and there would be a vote. There were 11 members of the commission and there were a couple of votes that were 6-5. But, you know, time after time after time, the commission kind of slowly eased its way toward these conclusions, and they brought people on board. It seems completely at odds with what we know about LBJ for him to appoint a commission and have it get away from him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I said, did he just simply want a rubber stamp? And Senator Harris said, no, I don't think he did. I think he wanted us. He had legitimate curiosity about what was happening. He had concern about how to stop it, but he wasn't prepared for the commission to go as far as it did. And he also made it seem that the changing political climate in the country heightened LBJ's concern about it. Mm-hmm. That people were, other people in the Senate, people who were in Congress and in the White House were saying, look, you know, I'm hearing rumblings about this report. You really can't endorse this, you know. If these guys say this, then, you know, what will happen in November? And by the time the report came out, which, you know, it was leaked before it actually arrived. But by the time the report came out, it was thoroughly radioactive.
We're talking to Jelani Cobb, historian and journalist. His new book is called The Essential Kerner Commission. You know, talk about the role of the media that you just referred to before in terms of their coverage of what was going on in urban America back in the late 60s.
So one of the things that they did, which was really ahead of its time, was that they did a media analysis. And they looked at the ways that issues in the communities affected had been covered, the ways that these uprisings themselves had been covered. They said that media had, in some instances, inflamed the tensions. And they noted that there was a desperate need for people to diversify media representations. And that was really, I mean, that's a conversation we're still having now, obviously.
Right.
But you wouldn't anticipate, you know, a panel of government bureaucrats and you know, people who are advocates on various issues to have thought that in depth and that precisely and insightfully about media, an institution that no one on the commission was connected to. There were no journalists or publishers or any of that sort on the commission. And so it remains one of the things I think that's most insightful and most perceptive that, you know, the commission thought about and wrote in their final report.
You know, I was watching you on being interviewed, Jelani Cobb, on Jim's TV show, and you had a beautiful bookcase behind you. We all are supposed to be in front of our beautiful bookcases.
If we have them.
but you had a book there by A.J. Liebling, who was a famed New Yorker writer and also a famed press critic. And I looked it up.
You were really paying close attention to the show.
Well, I was paying very close attention. Well, I always like to see what books people have, you know, and a cute picture of the baby, nice stuff of your own. But A.J. Liebling. But anyway, the reason I mention is because he was a big critic of the press, even though he's a member of the press. And he talked about that. You know, the function of the press is to inform, but its role is to make money. That's one of his famous quotes about the press. And the reason I bring that up is because I think that now that a lot – there's such racism on a regular basis on Fox News, which is one of the biggest drivers of news and media. It gets a lot of viewers on cable, the most popular cable network. I wonder what you think the role of Fox and some other places that are – pretty racist in their coverage of what's been going on with police brutality and other things in urban America lately.
Sure. And I would add to that, you know, to Liebling's point, you know, also Janet Malcolm, you know, another New Yorker writer who made similar critiques of the press. And you know, she famously noted that, you know, I hope I don't mangle this quote too much, but she said that, you know, any journalist who's honest about the profession knows that what we do is indefensible.
Boy, that's a great one. Oh, no, you've ruined my day now.
I know. You know, but I think that for better or worse, I don't know whether this is better or worse, you know, what we see in Fox News is a reinvention of an older model of media, you know, the early 20th century form, the old political newspapers, you know, where the newspapers that were unabashedly Republican papers or avowedly Democratic papers, and you would get news based upon that particular slant. And, you know, it wasn't until the middle of the 20th century, you know, World War II, and especially McCarthyism, that people realized the need to have a kind of public stance that was above the fray and to speak in, you know, the kind of disinterested voice of objectivity, which really turned out to be the disinterested voice of middle-aged, upper-income, WASP white men.
Yeah.
And so, but it was, that was the voice of neutrality. And, you know, for better or worse, you know, that that pretense of neutrality and objectivity, you know, had its virtues. And Fox has simply dispensed with that. You know, I don't think that we can really refer to it in the way that it operates as, you know, a news organization. It's something, it's a communications company, it's a propaganda outlet, but there doesn't exist there any pretense or any real sense of attempting to understand things from a complicated perspective. Or to deviate apart from, you know, what they perceive as the agenda of, you know, the right wing in the United States. And so I don't, I just don't think that that's consistent with what we think of, you know, as a press outlet, or what we should think of as a press outlet after, you know, 1950 in the United States.
We're talking to Jelani Cobb, his latest, the Essential Kerner Commission Report. One more thing, Jelani, using your words from a minute ago from the report itself, when you were talking about their analysis of the media was ahead of its time. We talked the other night, too, while Marjorie was studying your bookcase about the and by the way, it was a lot better when the sirens were blaring in the background during the interview.
Yeah.
But you can only do what you can do. Defunding the police, which obviously doesn't mean to most people in 2021 defunding the police, rather shifting some resources to other things, like we talked to a mayor the other day who was doing that in his community in Massachusetts, a share to mental health provision in Lynn, Massachusetts. They were ahead of their time there, too. Talk a little bit about what they were saying. On that.
They were. And so, you know, when people talk about defund the police, you know, it's a slogan that tends to attract people or alienate them, or, but nothing in the middle. And it really doesn't invite nuance from either of those perspectives. But the idea at the heart of it, of shifting resources away from simply having a law enforcement response to every single problem that we have, is not as radical as it seems on its face, or as it seems in, you know, the course of American politics right now, as evidenced by the fact that, you know, the Kerner Commission report suggested this 53 years ago. And they didn't use the phrase defund the police, but what they did say was that people who live in the ghetto, when they use that term, tended to have a huge number of interactions with the police around a whole array of different concerns, many of which did not technically fall under the rubric of law enforcement. And, you know, one of the classic examples of this that we see now is like mental health crisis. You know, it's no longer, it's no more illegal to have a mental health crisis than it is to have a heart attack. But if someone had a heart attack, we wouldn't call the cops on them. And so they pointed this out. They said that there needed to be alternate structures and alternate institutions that people interact with, as opposed to simply the police, because every time you call the police, there is a chance of that interaction going wrong and going fatally wrong.
You know,
and so
I'm sorry.
Yeah, and so that was you know, their very prescient observation.
You know, in a minute, we want to spend a minute or two on your HBO work on Obama before you go. But before you do, you know, not only am I interested in LBJ's decision-making once the report came out, I also hadn't thought about it until a minute ago. Can you give us a minute on what was in Governor Kerner that caused him to take this stance? I mean, was this to be expected? But he was governor of Illinois, right? What was, based right. upon his history, was this out of character, in character? What's that history?
So there are a couple things that I wanted to delve a little bit more into. One of which is the exact story of how Otto Kerner came to be, you know, appointed to this commission. It was not an issue that he had shown a great deal, a tremendous deal of interest in, you know, prior to this. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he wasn't a person, you know, that was on the outside of the question, the issue. It seemed to me that it could have potentially been a favor to the president. And the reason I say that is just the interesting timing of the fact that does this commission, he chairs this commission. He was, by every person, every standard I've seen, very involved. He wasn't just a name, you know, at the top of the letterhead. You know, he was very much involved in the actual execution of the report. And then within a year of the report, actually shorter than that, LBJ appointed him to the federal bench. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those two things could have been coincidental, or could have just been, you know, the kind of political horse trading that, you know, would have been very familiar to anybody who's seen, who knew Lyndon B. Johnson.
So, Jelani Cobb, Jim mentioned the documentary you've done on HBO on Obama, which, in addition to watching you on Jim's show, I'm watching as well. I was horrified in a way to see that Obama really looked like a baby when he was running for president.
Why does he look like a,
and we always talk about how presidents age, and the contrast is amazing. But anyway, tell people about this documentary that's on HBO right now.
Sure, I will say presidents age, but not Trump. As I've noticed.
That's a very good point.
You know, that is a good point. What is the secret there?
Pretty much the same.
His moisturizer.
The secret is that the other people actually were worried about the country.
That's a very good point.
I think it's the concern about the country that puts years on it. Even people who you disagree with, yeah. You know, people who I disagreed with politically.
Yeah.
You know, Bush, Reagan,
yeah.
They aged.
Yeah.
You know, Trump didn't.
Boy, and I never thought of that.
Consequently, why would he?
I think he put on some pounds, Jelani. He did put on some pounds, didn't he?
But
I think
so. Let's get back to the document. We want to hear about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the documentary, you know, which I was an executive producer for it, and Peter Coonhart directed, and, you know, I was very happy to work with him and, you know, the team at Coonhart Films, you know, who've done such, you know, great work. Prior to this, the conversation that we had around this was, you know, understanding Obama, you know, through the lens of race in the presidency, you know, given that more perfect union speech that he gave during the campaign, and that really indelible articulation he made of the problem of race in American society. And we kind of said this is a through line to understand the presidency. But to your point, one of the things that was very notable as we were going through that footage was just how much Obama aged, you know, over the course of those 8 years.
Yeah. Yeah. It really is an incredible thing. Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
You did a great job. Jelani Cobb is a staff writer at The New Yorker and now the dean of the Journalism School at Columbia University. Coming up, documentarian Ken Burns explains why he chose to highlight founding father Ben Franklin for his latest project.
This is Boston Public Radio. We're on tape today, sharing some of our favorite conversations from shows past. Here's Ken Burns on his latest documentary project, Benjamin Franklin. Ken, it's great to see you again. How are you?
I'm great, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. Yeah.
thank you so much for joining us. So, as usual, I learned a million things I didn't know. Mortified once again.
Me too.
I'm a Philly boy, so I have no excuse.
me too. You know, we don't go and tell you what we already know, because that would be a 5-minute short and it would be half wrong. Okay. But we share with you our process of discovery, so you can hide behind my ignorance as well.
Well, good. That makes me feel better. But why did you choose Benjamin Franklin, Ken Burns? What was the thinking?
The decisions are both intimate and emotional, like the way, why is your best friend your best friend? You know, you can't really remember the mental aspect of it. And these are also collective, right? So it's Dayton Duncan who wrote the script. It was Walter Isaacson who wrote one of the biographies that we drew from. It was, you know, the kind of collective sense. But it was, I think Jim encapsulated it very much. I mean, that here you have someone who just seems so utterly available and human to us. And at the same time, when you just line up a handful of his things, he's the best writer, American writer in the 18th century. He's a successful businessman. He's a world-class scientist. He'd get a Nobel Prize if there were Nobel Prizes to get for his work in electricity. He's an inventor, all of which he holds without, you know, patent. Get back to that later. He's a reluctant revolutionary. He's trying to forge connections. He's in politics. He's the greatest diplomat in American history, period. Know him, know us. And he, at the end of his life, after having owned other human beings, and started a school for Black kids in Philadelphia that he was shocked to discover had equal potential to white kids, he becomes an abolitionist and introduces the earliest resolution into a very brand new America, asking for the abolition of slavery. It, of course, goes nowhere and sets in motion the Civil War. But this is just, those are just glossing over the highlights. And he's on the $100 bill. So he gets appropriated by each generation as this symbol of upward mobility. And the thing is, it's like they own half a $100 bill. If you think that's all he is, right? It's all about doing for self. You've missed the other half. Your bill isn't worth $100 until you can connect it to what he felt was a kind of civic responsibility. So he was about doing better, but he's also about all of us doing better. He was born in what would become the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and he died in what was the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
You know, Ken Burns, you mentioned the scientist inventor side of him. From when he was a little kid, I made a quick list, from inventing fins so that he could swim faster, which I'd never heard before, lightning rod, lending library, college jet stream, home delivery of mail. I think letters to the editor, if I'm right, started with him. Of course, his most important invention, which doesn't get nearly enough attention, is the flexible catheter. I should say all of us appreciate that quite often. Why no patent? You mentioned it a minute ago. That's a big deal. Why?
I think he wanted everything he did to be useful, not just to himself. He'd made enough money. He'd retired. And he's now in this he didn't need to do more. He didn't need to double and triple it. And so he held all of these things without patent because he felt it was his responsibility to do something that was useful to society. So these experiments in lightning, which are theoretical, are interesting, but until they have a practical use, the lightning rod, which is going to save thousands of lives that year when it's invented, and thousands of lives this year, he's not going to do it. So he's looking for those things. But also think about how he also understood how to talk to people. A reporter asked me weeks ago, you know, what would he think? He'd be totally confused by social media. And I said, he was social media, right? He was a printer. He was a publisher. He was a newspaper man. He was a postmaster. He controlled the comings. He was Google. He was Apple. He was, you know, Twitter and Facebook all in one. He would get it in a second. But I think he understood that there was something larger debt to himself. I mean, he said as his creed, he evolves from born in Puritan Boston under the, you know, the dicta of the Mathers to a kind of more tolerant Pennsylvania, which is founded by Quakers, that he kind of adopts the deism that so many of the other founders had, which was that there's a disinterested God, but that God is pleased by the good works you do for others.
By the way, I love Mandy Patinkin before your film, but to say that he is the perfect voice of Benjamin Franklin is a grotesque understatement. He was beautiful.
You know, I'll take full credit for all of that because I had an inspiration watching Homeland in COVID with my little gal, with my little gal who should not have been watching, and I'm covering her up her eyes, and I'm trying to explain spycraft and statecraft to her, and then all of a sudden I go, oh, he's perfect. And so we reached out, and we did it all in COVID, Jim, and it was just he was amazing, and he now considers it up there with Sunday in the Park and George and Princess Bride. Oh. His greatest things. And I said, what about Saul Berenson in Homeland? He said, yeah, but this was what great. Was great. Yeah, he's so wonderful. And God bless him. He is such a great soul.
So
great
glad soul. To hear that.
We're talking to Ken Burns about his latest documentary on Benjamin Franklin. You know, you mentioned your little gal. Tell us just a little bit about Ben Franklin's young life. You know, very little education, having to escape the indentured situation he was in with his older brother. Tell us a little bit about that.
So he's born into a lower middle class family. You know, there's lots of kids from two wives. One dies, and his is the second wife, and he joins, as you said, his. This is the key. The parents think they can get him to Harvard, and that means he's got to have an education. But they're lower middle class. They make candles, and so they can't. So he gets 2 years of schooling. And as the writer H.W. Brand says in our film, it's so smart. He says, because he had no education to speak of, he didn't know what he didn't have to know. So he then presumed that he have to know everything. And so he's already this omnivorous, curious kid, an inventive kid, as Jim's pointed out, all of this stuff. But now it's more so. He can't stop reading about everything. And I think that's the key to who he is. So he's even as a teenager, he's writing these witty things that sound like somebody spoofing the college admissions cuckoo-ness of today about Harvard. And he's doing it with a pseudonym, and everybody thinks it's brilliant. And because it's uncovered that it's him, his brother's very jealous, and he sort of leaves and ends up, to Boston's loss and Philadelphia's gain in Pennsylvania.
By the way, that pseudonym was Mrs. Silence Duguid is the name that he used. And here's Mandy Patinkin again reading one of the many social critiques Franklin published in the New England Courant. And this one, as Ken Burns just said, is about Harvard. Here it is.
Most of them consulted their own purses instead of their children's capacities. At Harvard, they learned little more than how to carry themselves handsomely and enter a room genteelly. And from whence they return, after abundance of trouble and charge, as great blockheads as ever, only more proud and self-conceited.
You know what I should have added, Ken Burns, to the list of inventions is political humor. I mean, whether it was Poor Richard's Almanac or here, I mean, he was Mark Twain before Mark Twain. Yes?
Yeah, that's what Walter Isaacson, and I agree with him. He's in that tradition. He invents an American kind of humor. He's stealing the stuff of the almanacs, but he's making it better in the stealing. It's coming from British almanacs and British periodicals and things like that. But he's doing it in a way, and he's got this kind of wink at us that's so great. Yeah, I would go even further and just say, as many of the scholars in the film do, his greatest invention is himself. He is always interested in self-improvement. A lot of that is about the public-facing part of it. You know, so he says, let all men know me, but no men thoroughly. So, you know, there's an opacity to this openness and that transparency, which is contradictory, just as everything else, the owning of other human beings and promoting abolition, all of this stuff in his life. But he's always curious, and to his ever loving and our credit, he is about improvement and about getting better and not being stuck and not being static. And so this old man at the end of his life becomes a revolutionary. And this old man, after he's helped create the United States, becomes an abolitionist. It's just, you can't make it up.
Let's play a little piece of that with Walter Isaacson, his biographer, speaking. It's a prime example, as Kember just talked about, of Franklin's dedication to self-improvement and his own flawed nature. He determined there are 12 virtues that will lead one to moral perfection, and he charted his progress every week, showing it off to friends when he felt he'd mastered a virtue. Here it is.
Every week, Franklin would make a chart and check, did he master the virtue? At one point, he said, I mastered all the 12 virtues I had, and I showed it around with great pride. And one of my friends said, Franklin, you're missing a virtue you might want to try. And Franklin says, what's that? And the friend says, humility. You might want to add that one to your list.
And he did, Marjorie, he did. He added it to his list and then was self-critical, saying, you know, if I'd mastered that, I probably would have been prideful in telling people that I had mastered it. So his tongue was in cheek, but it had that sense the way Twain did too, that Twain said that the source of laughter is not joy, but sorrow. There's no laughter in heaven. And I think both of these very funny men understood from personal experience, but also from watching human life, the ultimate tragedy of things. And so much of what they were able to negotiate into goodness comes from that deep understanding of the big question of life, which is none of us get out of here alive.
You know, another thing that of the many things that I learned was about this somewhat tragic relationship between Franklin and his son, William. Tell people about that.
Yeah, so they were best friends, you know, in the best sense of the word, as a father and son can be, doing everything together. He's there, the only person that Franklin will let observe and help on the kite experiment, the famous kite experiment. They're in Europe together. They're inseparable. And he's trained him to be a loyal, as Franklin intended to be, Briton. And Franklin was hoping that if his wife, Deborah, you know, got over her fear of sailing, a legitimate one, across the Atlantic, that he'd be there and we'd know him for his scientific advancement. The son is groomed and he becomes a royal governor of New Jersey. He's the last royal governor to be deposed in the revolution. And it's assumed that he'll just, you know, be quiet. And he isn't. He's a mischief maker and he's put in prison. His wife dies while he's there. His health fails. And when he's finally exchanged in a prisoner exchange deep into the revolution, it's presumed he'd go to London. And he stays around and starts a terrorist organization killing patriots. Now, let's just be fair. There's lots of other organizations of patriots killing loyalists. This is a civil war, where our civil war was not. Our civil war was a sectional war, North against South. But the great tragedy is that he loses his son, and his son tries to come back, and Franklin won't have it. It's just one of those things that reminds us of the kind of interiors of history that also prove the larger things, or that help put in relief those larger themes that you're trying to get across. All of this stuff, however bold-faced the name, happens within the human dynamic that we all experience. And we all have the example or know of an example of family members that are estranged, or the difficulties that happen when you end up on two sides of a political argument. You know, it's happening right now in our country. So
right to his death. I think you mentioned he gave money to his family and heirs, but not to William.
And he left money to two essentially technical schools. The idea that young, up and coming leather apron kids, the way he had been, in Boston and Philadelphia, and they're still around, and they're still, I talked with the Boston group, the Franklin Institute, Cummins Institute, they're still producing mostly from, you know, recent immigrants, second generation folks, people of color, but everybody, tradesmen and tradespeople who are just continuing this genius. And you can look in each one of their faces and see that potentiality that Franklin admired so much.
Ken Burns, I want to revisit the slavery issue you talked about with Benjamin Franklin. Is, in addition to owning slaves and continuing to own them, in his newspaper, he put out ads for slaves who had escaped. I mean, did essentially all the wrong things. And ultimately, there was that petition very late in his life to Congress, which failed, obviously, on the abolitionist side. I can't remember. Please refresh it. When I saw the film, was it when he was in London and a slave sent their kid to school and he was surprised that the kid, the son of the slave, did as well in school as all the kids? What was the epiphany moment?
Yes. Yeah, so I think there's a few. We don't know what he did with the slaves, whether they died out or they escaped or whatever. Uh-huh. One slave ran away in London, and there was an ad for the return of that slave, but by William, his son, still an ostrich. But he'd started a school for black kids in North America, in Philadelphia, and came back and at his wife's, Deborah's, urging, went to visit it and was stunned, shocked to find them as as filled with potential as white kids. And I think that's the beginning of it. So by the end of his life, way ahead of most of the thinking in any of the colonies, he is asked ahead and accepts the presidency of the Pennsylvania Society for Promoting the Abolition of Slavery, and writes an amazing thing to the Constitution, I mean, to the Congress. The Senate doesn't take it up. The House votes it down and gives the reasons, and the outcry in the South is so great that he feels like he's got to write something as he did, and he puts their stupid arguments into the mouth of a Muslim from North Africa who has, as there were, Christian slaves, and why he can't release them or end these things. And it just shows the hypocrisy, but it's to no avail. We got a civil war.
Well, I got every single fact wrong there, but the essence of what I was saying, I think I got
well, Jim, your heart's in the right place.
You know what, Alfred?
But you know what? There's no test. There's no test on Tuesday.
That's right. Well, another thing I love was when John Adams goes to France and is rather appalled because at this stage of his life, Benjamin Franklin was a little bit of a bon vivant, flirting with the women in the French court, and I guess he kept a very messy desk. So what was the dynamic between the two of them?
Well, you've got, you know, well, there, it's a good cop, bad cop thing, as Joe Ellis says. I mean, it's really classic. Franklin's laid the groundwork. He's understood that in order to woo the French court, you can't step on the accelerator. You got to basically live it the way they do, right? With double entendres and puns and all of this sort of stuff. And he does it. And you've got the Puritan descendant John Adams coming in there going, where's early to bed? Where's Poor Richard? Where's what's going on here? But the thing is, he also cannot stand the fact that Franklin is beloved by everybody in France. And then there's this, you know, this Voltaire, who's just weeks away from death. They come and they want Franklin to embrace him on stage. And John Adams has to watch this from the sidelines. And, you know, in a little bit, he's a kind of a foil in the story of Franklin, but they're both excellent. And they both, you know, let's just remember that Franklin negotiates the French stuff. It's just unbelievable. No him, no victory at Yorktown, no revolution. But then they both negotiate the Treaty of Paris, and they are tough as nails, and it's the most lopsided treaty in all of American history. We get everything, the Brits get nothing, and the French get nothing. And it's like Franklin's there to go, sorry, but can you give us more money? And the French go, we're really unhappy, but okay.
Yeah.
You know, Ken Burns, I know the film obviously was made long before Russia invaded Ukraine, but I don't know how recently you've seen it. Marjorie and I both watched both episodes of your film this weekend. It is really hard to not have Ukraine in your mind when you're reading about the revolution, is it not?
So no, Jim. And you know, I promise you, we don't work our films thinking, oh, this is going to be contemporary. We just know it will be. Mm-hmm. We just got to struggle to tell this story and what you can leave out and how, with no photographs and no footage, you can make the 18th century come alive and people come alive. But I think you can remember what Ecclesiastes said: what has been will be again, what has been done will be done again, there's nothing new under the sun. And so what you're doing is just activating something elemental and truthful about that moment. It happens to be the 18th century, this enormous lifespan of this protean figure in our history that we don't know enough about. But whatever is true to it will resonate with everything that's going on today. Look, it's got inoculations. It's got political divide. It's got religious divide. It's got false information. It's got fake news. Everything is there. That's because human nature doesn't change. And I'll never run out of topics in American history, because they'll be, in some ways, I guess, guides to who we are at this moment right now.
Well, I know I speak for Mark. We thoroughly enjoy. Oh, I thought we were.
Just one more thing, if we have time before Ken Burns goes.
Yeah.
It was a little disheartening, though, to me to think about Franklin and his unbelievable accomplishments. Obviously, he's unusual. But then you think Thomas Jefferson was unusual. Hamilton was unusual. Where are the leaders in 2021 or 2022, I should say? I mean, was that just a blip in our history?
No, we don't select for them, right? We're in a binary world, computer world and media culture. Everything's yes or no, good or bad. If that's your criteria, nobody succeeds. Everybody fails. And so we've got to, what I think one of the gifts of history is, it reminds us how complicated our greatest heroes are. And we throw people out for crimes that are, you know, I don't mean crimes, but I mean for failings of Thomas Jefferson, or failings and crimes of Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin, you know, and we've got to understand a way to see this a little bit more clearly.
Ken Burns, as I started to say, we loved it. We really learned a lot. Yeah. We loved so every glad. Minute. Thank Congratulations. You. Yeah.
Ken Burns is an award-winning documentarian. Up next, writer and naturalist Cy Montgomery shares her experiences with falconry through her amazing book, The Hawk's Way, Encounters with Fierce Beauty.
This is Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're replaying some of our favorite conversations. We pick things up with writer and naturalist Cy Montgomery sharing her latest book, The Hawk's Way, Encounters with Fierce Beauty.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marge Regan. A single mistake handling a raptor, journalist and naturalist Cy Montgomery writes, even one you know well may provoke it to bite you, stab its talons in your flesh, or both. Sounds good to me. That's her new fabulous book out this week. It's called The Hawk's Way, Encounters with Fierce Beauty. Here to tell us about these dangerous and beautiful living dinosaurs is Cy Montgomery. Cy is obviously a journalist, naturalist, New York Times bestselling author, BPR contributor. Two other things I will say about her. We've been talking to you for years. I think we've met you once ever in person. Which
and here
is
she is.
We're so happy
here
to
she
have
is.
You. And secondly, we know she's thrilled because she's a great author to be at the library. But I know it's disappointing. You are not at a library that has a Peeps diorama like your hometown library in Hancock. Is that upsetting to you, Cy Montgomery?
No, it is not at all. But it is my pleasure to present to both of you. Not the key to the city, because we don't have a city.
Okay.
And we don't have any keys, because our doors are always open. But you can be honorary residents
of Hancock?
Of Hancock, New Hampshire.
There you go.
Population 1,700. Come to our Hancock market. And there you will meet everybody who hangs out.
Can we hear it for that? We
yes,
didn't get a
absolutely.
Key, but we did get...
We did.
Thank you, Simon. So, and thanks to the people of Hancock for their generosity.
Your latest book, I mean, you've written so many great books, but this latest one, I think a lot of us, I didn't know anything about falconing. I mean, I saw
neither
Harry are. Potter. I think there was some falconing in Harry Potter or something. So tell us how you got involved with these hawks through your friend Nancy
Cowan,
if I'm pronouncing it correctly.
Well, yeah. my husband, Howard Mansfield, heard an advertisement on the radio in, I think, 2005, that a new school was opening up in Deering, New Hampshire, not far from us in Hancock, and it was the New Hampshire School of Falconry, and he knew right away that I had to go there. In fact, I was Nancy's first student, and I brought with me my friend Celinda Chicoin, and it was the most amazing experience. We meet her. She spoke with us a little bit about falconry and handed us each a bird of prey. I had on my glove Jazz, a gorgeous Harris's hawk, big, big animal, mahogany eyes that looked like they were devouring the world, and great, strong, yellow feet tipped in ebony talons. Celinda had a Lanner falcon, and my instructor chose a peregrine falcon, who, within the first 5 minutes of our meeting, bit her in the face.
Yeah.
And we're walking down the street, three middle-aged ladies holding these birds of prey, one of them bleeding profusely onto the sidewalk. And the next thing we know, someone pulls up, hands Nancy a dead bird from the back seat, which I thought she was going to feed to the hawks, but was going to eat for dinner. And I thought, what have I gotten myself into? What is this?
Yeah.
But, you know, I've been a vegetarian for like 40 years, and if I see a squirrel hit on the road, I'm like sick for the rest of the day. But I was working with hunters. These birds are hunters. And once I looked into the eyes of this gorgeous, majestic creature, I felt like I was holding on my glove wildness itself. And I wanted what that bird wanted. And in that way, I hoped that I could become a worthy junior hunting partner.
You know, Cy Montgomery, we have talked to you about many of your incredible relationships with animals. I mean, is Octavia was the name of the octopus? Octavia, The Soul of the Octopus is one of the great interspecies books ever. And Octavia was the octopus you had the relationship with, essentially. Is that okay?
We were good friends.
You were good. Well, you're good friends. And the tactile connection between you, I mean, just I've never read anything like this in my whole life. You make clear in your book, this is unlike the relationship between human, you, and Hawk, or any human and Hawk, is unlike any you've ever experienced in love, but you love this. So describe that relationship, which, as you say, is not reciprocal in lots of ways, and why this is okay with you, and why you loved it, not just okay with you.
Yeah. Well, I've had a lot of animal friends, including octopus, and usually through gentle touch, you can become good friends with these creatures. I mean, pigs and dogs and... even I got a rhinoceros to roll over once by touching. I mean, it was somebody's rhinoceros. It wasn't like a wild rhinoceros. Don't try this at home. But a hawk is totally different, and it was more alien to me, I think, than even an octopus, even though we're more closely related to birds. Who are the descendants of theropod dinosaurs than we are to octopuses, because we go back, our last common ancestor with an octopus is half a billion years ago when everybody was a tube. So when I meet a new animal, I'm just open to whatever it is that they want. They do not want to be touched. They do not want to be stroked. So right away, the normal way that you kind of get to know somebody, once that you've convinced them that you're not going to hurt them, normally the way you get someone like that to know you is through touch, but they don't want that. They want something totally different. They want something totally different from what I want. They want to chase and capture and kill and eat prey. That is the thing that they love to do.
And they want you to help facilitate that behavior, do they not?
Right. Otherwise, you have very little to offer them.
Explain to, I mean, you mentioned one of your neighbors is a falconer. So the hawks fly away to get their prey, and then they come back. Mm-hmm. So obviously they have some kind of relationship with the person that's the owner. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, the hawk, if you've been able to show them that you're a worthy hunting partner and that you can be trusted, right before they've had all they want to eat, you try to figure out, like, when should I call it out of the sky to my glove? And you call it out of the sky to your glove with
how
a bit of food.
It?
Oh, you whistle, okay. Or you can just slap the glove.
Okay.
Hold up a chicken, whatever.
Well, you have a tiny bit of a chicken. Their eyes are amazing. I mean, they can see this from very far away. Their eyes are twice the size of their brain.
I know. Let's get to that in a second. I couldn't get over that, but go ahead.
So they can see, like, the little chick head, even if they're, you know, hundreds of feet away, they see that you're holding something delicious. And so they'll come to you. And they have little anklets on them called jesses. And so if the hawk is done hunting or you're done with a training session, you can hook them up to the jesses and then bring them back to the house. But, you know, if you make a mistake, or if your hawk just decides you're useless, or if your hawk decides something is more interesting than you, they can fly away. They are so not your pet. They are so not under your control at all.
But when they live with the neighbor, where do they live?
At night, they sleep in an aviary called a mews.
Okay.
And they are safe there from raptors, you know, like owls who might want to eat them, and warm. And in the morning, he comes and feeds Mahood, and then they go out hunting together.
And do they do this every day, several times a week?
I think whenever they can.
Yeah.
The thing about the Harris hawk is they're a southwestern species, so they really hate snow.
Oh.
And no one likes to fly in the rain.
Yeah.
So, you know, if it's raining, if it's snowing, you know, they don't, at least Harris hawks don't want to go anywhere. So they're hanging out at home.
Simon, I'm sorry.
go ahead.
Simon Montgomery, there are beautiful photographs in this book, too, by the way. Who took the photographs?
Beautiful.
Tia Strombeck, my friend.
Fabulous.
Look at this one. She's like 4 inches away from this hawk looking right at you.
Well, actually, even closer, my favorite photograph is a beautiful profile of your now late friend, unfortunately, to whom you dedicate the book, Nancy Cowan, with this hawk on her left shoulder. It's a beautiful profile of both. But the takeaway from me is what you just mentioned. I couldn't take my eyes off the eyes of these hawks. First of all, when you said a minute ago, Simon Montgomery, that their eyes are twice the size of their brains, you mean that literally?
Yes.
Is that
yes.
Correct?
Yes.
So you can extrapolate, if that was in a human being, it'd be like the size of a watermelon or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
That whatever.
We would have eyes, if our eyes were big as, say, an owl's, our eyes would be the size of oranges.
That's incredible. So describe the eye of the hawk and obviously how valuable it is to it in doing what it does, which is be a predator, a hunter.
Yeah, they because they're flying creatures, your eyes need to apprehend your environment in greater detail and more rapidly than our eyes do. And we're primates, so we care a lot about our vision.
Right.
You know, and our other senses are relatively weak. We can hear okay, our sense of smell is terrible, but compared to a raptor, we're Mr. Magoo. They can be hundreds, thousands of feet in the air and see over an area of like 2 miles in exquisite detail. And they probably see colors we can't even name. The numbers of receptors, they have like a million light receptors in their eyes. We have something like 200,000. So what they see, like when we from an airplane look down and we see broccoli, you know, when we see trees, it just looks like a bunch of broccoli. To them, they can see each individual leaf and probably in colors that we cannot describe. And they can also see with great rapidity. So a hummingbird's wing, which looks like a blur to us, they see slow individual wing beats.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
What was the name? Your last book was on hummingbirds. Speaking of, what was the name of the hummingbird book? If you want to grab that.
The Hummingbird's Gift.
That was a beautiful book. So if we see a hawk somewhere, you know, when we're out with our little dogs, we should keep our eye on the little dog and the hawk.
Yeah, particularly the first prey item that the peregrine falcons hunted when they were reintroduced to New York City was unfortunately a chihuahua and not a pigeon.
Oh.
So, yeah. Little dogs, if you see a peregrine overhead, I would take your dog in. But you know what? Our border collie was hunted, although not attacked, by a great horned owl, a border collie.
That's a pretty good-sized dog, right?
I know. 40-pound dog. Well, actually, that was Tess, so she was more like 30 pounds. But great horned owls hunt skunks. And she was black and white because she was a border collie. And my husband was out, and he saw this like thing, like a giant cinder, float out of nowhere while he was taking Tess out in the evening. And it swooped down, and the owl thought, you know, that looks like a delicious skunk. Oh, no, it's not a skunk, and it left.
Wow.
I don't think I'll be going to Hancock anytime soon. Despite the honor that was bestowed on us, Simon Montgomery, I'll tell you.
I mean, this is pretty unusual stuff, though. I mean, I'd never, like I said, except for the Harry Potter things, I'd heard of, you know, falconers. But, I mean, I didn't really know they were existing up there in New Hampshire or anyplace else.
Well, it's because of Nancy that the New Hampshire School of Falconry was founded.
And who goes to the New Hampshire School of Falconry?
Well, right now, alas, since she died,
yeah.
The school is going to move somewhere to Massachusetts, and one of her apprentices is going to be able to practice, you know, teach people falconry there. But, gosh, I was so lucky to be her first student, and I was so lucky to keep coming back and back and back, and I would bring friends of mine from the aquarium would come, and it's just the most amazing thing to see this living dinosaur come flying toward you on purpose to land on your glove
and to eat your face. I ask you this almost all the time when we're talking about some wild are you not scared? I know you love everything that is breathing and living. We're not going to ask you about the rats we were talking about yesterday because I know you love them too.
It's
but
true.
Are you not petrified when this damn bird is flying down to your glove that you're holding up with little food, that you're its next food? You're not nervous about that?
I am petrified.
Oh, you are?
A cocktail party.
With humans, of course.
So how heavy are these birds? When they land on your forearm, they're pretty heavy.
Well, you'd think. You feel them, I mean, actually smack onto your glove.
With their big claws.
Right, and you feel the squeeze.
Yeah.
But it's not from their weight so much as from the velocity that they're coming at you.
So you could be knocked right over.
Well, I mean, I don't think I'd be knocked over because I was ready. I was ready for it. But I understand why some people would not be happy to see a raptor coming claws first.
Yeah, right. You know, I saw Jurassic Park.
Well, yeah. our kind, our ancestors, the Australopithecines. When you and I were in college, I'm sure you've heard of Raymond Dart's discovery of the Tong child, which was a young hominid who they thought was killed by a leopard when we were in college. But then that fossil has been re-examined. It was not killed by a leopard. It was killed by a huge hawk.
Mm. Yes. Comforting.
Oh,
you know, before
God.
You go, can we end with a question you never answered? What'd you do to the rhinoceros? I'm totally serious about this. What does the rhinoceros weigh, like 3,000 pounds, 2,000 pounds?
They're big
pounds?
Animals,
okay.
Yeah.
So, first of all, I assume everything you say, I take it face value, you literally got it to roll over on its back.
I did.
What
did
you do to the rhinoceros?
Well, first, I do want to reiterate, this wasn't a wild rhinoceros.
Well,
it's
still a rhinoceros.
I used the technique that worked on my pig, Christopher Hogwood, and will work on people if you know them well enough.
Okay.
You rub their inguinal region.
Excuse me?
What's that? I don't know
well,
about that.
Well, it's kind of where your legs join your belly. Not all the way under there, because you're not getting that familiar.
No, I hope not,
No. But they like being rubbed there, and they just flip over in porcine bliss.
That is unbelievable.
Like a dog.
Yes, like a dog,
wow.
Like a pig. I mean, everyone seems to like that.
Even okay. Right now. Can I tell you something? Marjorie and I were talking. You are amazing. I mean, not only your relationship with other species, but this book... is so terrific and gives such insight in ways that I couldn't even imagine. You're amazing, Cyan. It's great to see you in person. We really
thank you
love
very,
talking
very
to you.
Much.
Thank
and
you
thank
so
you
much.
For our T-shirts. So I'm very happy about that. Cyan Montgomery is a journalist, naturalist, and Boston Public Radio contributor. Her latest book is The Hawk's Way, Encounters with Fierce Beauty. And she's written so many terrific books, which you will enjoy. Thank you again, Cyan Montgomery.
Next time you're here, in person, if you could bring that domesticated rhinoceros with you.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And do it. We'd love to see the technique. Cy, it's great to see you.
Cyan Montgomery is a journalist, naturalist, and Boston Public Radio contributor. Her latest book is The Hawk's Way, Encounters with Fierce Beauty. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Keep up with us 24/7 by way of our podcast. Tune in tomorrow when we'll be live at the Boston Public Library. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu joins us there for an hour. We'll also be joined by Michael Kirk, director of Frontline's latest film, Lies, Politics, and Democracy. Plus, NBC Sports' Trenny Casey is here as well. And CNN's John King. We want to thank our crew, Zoe Matthews, Aidan Conley, Mackenzie Farkas, additional support provided by Hallie Lerner and Kendrick Mercado. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. Our executive producer is James Bologna. You want to tell us what's on TV?
What I'd like to tell you, I'd very much like to tell you, actually.
Okay.
Two people are experts on Ukraine who have told me that the only time the war will end is when Putin is gone. We'll talk about whether the victories for the Ukrainians this weekend will speed that exit. And then Linda Pizzuti-Henry is going to join me. The Globe Summit is coming up this week. There's about to be a new editor right on top of there being new an editorial page editor. All those kinds of things and more. That's tonight at 7 on Greater Boston.
That sounds very exciting, Jim.
Well, thank you. I think so.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browning.
Thanks again for tuning in today. Hope you can tune in tomorrow. And meanwhile, have a great afternoon.